Thank you very much for coming back earlier than usual from lunch. I know you didn't have much choice, but I do appreciate it because it means we can get through what we need to get through this afternoon. As regards this morning's discussions with questions to NEGC Limited, I did say I'd be in touch via the programme officer to let you know if there's any further information I need on either the approach to contingencies or indeed the matters we're discussing later on about the approach to borrowing and the question of state guarantee and so on. So don't send me anything yet, but I'll write to you if we need anything. Thank you. So can we turn then, well, actually, before we turn to the appraisals that have been done on behalf of the of some of the various site promoters, just in terms of managing this afternoon's discussion, can I ask for an indication of who is likely to want to ask questions of Mr. Sunnox and Mr. O'Connell? As you know, they've both produced model-based analyses of the, particularly the highest appraisal. And I'm going to ask them to explain what they've done and what conclusions they've drawn from it as part of this discussion. But I'm just wondering how much time I'm going to need to allow for questions to them, because I'm not sure I've got very many, given that a lot of what they've had to say has been expressed in the form of questions and discussion already, and that, you know, I'm pretty clear about most of what they're saying in their material. But there may be others who have questions, so can I have an indication now if there are... Yeah. So there will be some. Yeah, there will be some. Okay, well, that's fine. So I'll make sure there's time allowed for that. Fine, thank you. Well, let's move then to the excuse me to the appraisal that's been done for Andrusfield New Settlement Consortium and Countryside. So we're looking at the G.L. Hearn work, aren't we? Mm. Thank you for your seminar paper. Could you start by giving a brief summary of the approach you've taken?
Yes, of course. Thank you, sir. G.L. Hearn is acting on behalf of the Andrusfield New Settlement Consortium, Countryside Properties, and we have produced a development vision.
Could you move the microphone a little bit closer to you?
Sure.
Make sure it's pointing straight at you, because it's quite sensitive to the position.
How's that?
That's much better.
Good. So back in September 2019, we provided a development vision for the land to the west of Braintree. And that vision document confirmed a total development site area of 1,633 acres. Now, we have produced a development appraisal in respect of that vision using Argus Developer software to arrive at a residual land value that has informed our view on viability. As part of that appraisal, we have produced cash flow setting out our forecast of income and costs, and this assumes build-out rates of 300 dwellings per annum, and as part of our sensitivity analysis, we've also assessed the implications of a lower 250 dwellings per annum over a longer period of a cash flow. We find that both are viable. We have used a simplistic high-level approach in terms of our timescales and a straight line averaging out of our variables on a month-by-month basis. As part of that analysis, we've also adjusted our finance assumptions in order to assess the sensitivity to fluctuations in debit interest. And it's our opinion that 6% debit interest is appropriate. However, our analysis of the higher 7% debit interest also shows the project to be viable, both in respect of the 300 and 250 dwellings per annum build-out rates. Our appraisal assumes that land acquisition begins in September 22, with the infrastructure construction commencing 1 year after that, bill costs following on 12 months after that, and we've also assumed sales income begins 2 years after the first land is acquired. The appraisal combines our opinion of residential sales values together with conventional growth implicit investment valuations for the commercial buildings, and we arrive at an overall gross development value from which we have deducted project costs, which we've taken from a combination of BCIS averages and the GLEEDS report in respect of infrastructure. We've taken contingencies at 10% of the total construction and infrastructure costs, and we've also deducted a developer's profit, 20% on GVD, which is the standard needed to secure finance in the market. All of which results in a residual land value. This, as I was saying earlier, is a deliberately simplistic approach that produces a current-day residual land value that informs our views on viability. This directly relates to whether or not there is sufficient premium over and above the existing use value to incentivize the landowner to dispose of their land for development. So, in assessing viability, we have deliberately chosen not to make explicit assumptions as to potential growth of income or inflation of costs, choosing instead to use today's values and avoid future gazing. At this early stage of high-level planning policy, we believe it could be misleading of viability appraisals to include such explicit assumptions. Instead, we believe that the policy setting stage should remain isolated from the subjective forecasting of growth and inflation over the next 3, 4, 5 decades. Our appraisal testing produces a residual land value of approximately £114,000 per acre, and that falls in line with the highest assessment.
Much. Just bear with me a second. Thank you. So, first of all, if you could turn to my table, page 4 of the agenda, and I suspect it may need some correction based on what you've said. So, first of all, the site area does correspond to the area that you've you mentioned, 661 hectares. So, now, can I understand what that represents in relation to the site that Hyas assessed, and this, in other words, the site we're concerned with in the plan. The original site area for Hyas, based on 12,500 dwellings. I think that's a 685 hectare figure, isn't it? Someone help me with that?
Yes.
685 hectares. And then there's the area of the west of Braintree development as assessed by Hyas, but including the Braintree district part only, is 496 hectares. So I'm just wondering what 661 hectares reflects in terms of, you know, what the site coverage is.
I think the easiest way to explain that is refer to the development vision, which we submitted. And if you go to page 23, there is a red line around the area which is included, and it is all of that area which is in Braintree, not in the Uttlesford district. Yeah, and if you look to the bottom left-hand corner of that table, or that picture, sorry, there is a table which shows the various land uses and how that 661 hectares is sort of divvied up between the different uses.
I can look that up. And in terms of control over the land. What's the situation as regards control over the land?
Sorry, could I just add as well, I should have said that the 661 does exclude the Galliard land as well.
Excludes Galliard, yeah. Right.
And apologies, I didn't hear your next question there.
So is all the 661 hectares under option, or what's the position on that?
There is a legal document in solicitor's hands at the moment, which is being progressed.
Being progressed?
Yeah.
Does that cover the whole land, the whole of the 661 hectare?
Hi. Sorry, just being put. I should also mention it is at the advanced stages of a collaboration agreement between the landowners and Countryside.
So, ANSC are the landowners, are they? Is that how it works? And Countryside are the developers?
Yes, that's correct. ANSC, the landowners.
So does the legal document that's being progressed, does that cover the whole of the 661 hectares?
I believe it does, yes.
Thank you. Okay, so that's the position on regards the area and land ownership. Number of dwellings 8306 is set in the model, isn't it? Build out rate. You say it's been assessed at 300 and 250.
Yeah, we assessed it at 300, and just taking on board your comments about sensitivity, we ran an analysis at the 250 as well.
Have you provided the 250 based assessment? I don't recall seeing it.
We haven't, no. That's just an analysis that we've done.
I see. And have you provided the 7% finance sensitivity?
Again, that's sensitivity analysis that we've run since submitting our last paper.
So I'm correct in saying in the table that what I've got in front of me is 300, is based on the 300 dwellings per annum delivery rate. Okay. In terms of infrastructure, have I got that right? 53208 is the per unit figure you've used.
Yes, that's correct. We've taken that from the GLEEDS report, EB087.
Yep. Yeah, it corresponds to the highest figure, albeit the highest figure for 12,500 dwellings. So that's clearly the tie-up there.
It does, yes, and we've done a little bit of a check. Just we've seen that ACOM have provided similar guidance on other garden community schemes, including Harlow, East Harts, and Epping Forest Councils. The 53 seems to be fairly widely accepted.
So this is, so you say HIAS have done this?
No, that's ACOM.
ACOM, I beg your pardon. ACOM have provided similar advice to which councils?
It's to the Harlow, yeah, East Hertfordshire and Epping Forest Councils.
Thank you. Now, contingencies. Just so I understand the approach you've taken to contingencies. My note says, I'm just looking for the source of this. There's 10% contingency on build costs, isn't there?
Yes, that's correct. It's a fairly sort of industry standard method to apply the 10% to the overall total of construction and infrastructure costs.
Yeah, I was just going to come on to infrastructure. So the 10% applies across the two.
It does, yeah. Infrastructure,
the two categories,
as well.
Infrastructure and build costs.
Correct.
And there's no other I lost the phrase, optimism bias or other contingency allowance built in over and above that 10%.
I suppose there is in our bill cost analysis, which we've taken BCIS. So BCIS averages, which we've adjusted for the location and rounded those up. That would be the only other contingency element I would highlight. Yeah. Rounded up before we then... I mean, we'll get onto this about externals, but then we add another 15% to that rounded up figure for externals.
And that's 15% on build costs for externals?
That's correct. So base build costs and prelims. So the BCIS figure covers base build costs and preliminaries as well. And then to that, it's another industry standard method to apply 15% addition for externals.
Yeah. Thank you. And then the profit allowance in the model is 20. Let me just get this.
So we've
20% on GDV.
That's correct, yeah. Which is kind of a generally accepted norm. I mean, I guess that has got a little bit of contingency built into that as well. You would often find that the 20% or the profit figure was made up of 20% on the private residential, and there would be lower profit margins on the affordable housing.
Yeah.
We've applied the 20% on the entirety.
Yeah. And on affordable housing, at 30%.
Yeah, so we've got a 70-30 split.
Yeah.
And of that 30% affordable, we have a 60-40 split. So 40 shared ownership, 60 affordable. And if you look at it in terms of what percentage of the overall total the shared ownership is, that is 12%.
That's shared ownership as opposed to...
As opposed to the total of affordable.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's another kind of driver that people take a note of, all of which is in line with what we understand to be policy.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. And so it's a residual land valuation model, so the costs and values are inputs, as is the profit rate. There's a single profit rate, isn't it? Am I right? There's a single
That's
profit.
Correct,
it's not.
Yeah.
It's not that sort of split between master developer and.
It's a single
and house builder. Yeah, single profit rate, based on 20% of gross development value. You take the costs away from the value, and you end up with your land price.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. And what's the approach? What's the assumed approach to land purchase in terms of timing of land purchase?
So we have our land acquisition starts on September 22 and runs for 343 months, or 28 years and 7 months, through to April 51. In our cash flow,
Does your cash flow profiles out land purchase costs equally over that period?
It does. It's a straight line average across the whole project period.
And are you able to say whether that how closely that reflects the real life situation? Are you the right person to ask that question?
I think for the purposes of the appraisal in terms of this high level policy setting, it's appropriate. I think if we were further along the line, then we would delve into more detail and drill down into more detail and include much more subjective variables in the way that some of the other attendees have been doing.
Thinking about the land purchase aspect, whether buying land in, I don't know, annual or biannual tranches is a realistic assumption in terms of what would happen in real life.
No, I think it's fair to say that clearly it wouldn't be that smooth average over that time period. You would peaks and troughs.
Yeah.
But for the purposes of this, averaging it out won't make too much of a difference to viability. I should say it shouldn't make too much of a difference to viability in our simplistic model. If we had a much more complicated, detailed model, it would have more of a subjective difference.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Does anyone have any questions they'd like to put to Mr. Sproul, isn't it?
Yes.
Let's hear Mrs. Luxford-Vaughan first, then.
It's very simple. Do you currently have an option on the site?
No, there is no current option on the site.
Just a quick follow-up to that one. Is the option under negotiation for equal purchase of the land up to 2051?
Not entirely sure of the answer to that one, but we can come back with further details. There is a collaboration agreement which is advanced with solicitors at the moment.
And can I follow up with a question about the interest calculation? I think I'm right in saying that you've got an interest credit. You haven't got an interest charge. You've got an interest credit of 32 million, which compares across to the highest interest charge of, and I'm afraid I can't remember the exact figure, but it's 200 or 300 million charge for Hias on here. So it's a huge difference in interest. We've had a little dig into why that is, and we've got some answers there, but you might be able to give some answers better than I can first.
Where do I find the interest figure, Mr. Sonics?
That will be on the second page, not including the front sheet of our appraisal summary. So, just above total costs.
Total finance cost, 32,034,488 million.
That's in brackets, and that's in brackets, which means it's added back. It's a plus. It helps the appraisal.
Yes. To explain this, it's a nuance of the Argus appraisal format. The excuse me, the debit interest is deducted immediately from the land value, so it doesn't appear here in the line, but it is deducted from the land value, residual value. We can do some digging and provide that in a different format if it helps.
A little bit more about that. So this is a feature of the Argos software, you're saying?
It is, and the way in which the appraisal has been set up on it. The debit interest is deleted straight from the residual land value as opposed to appearing here in on a line of its own. The easiest way might be to set the debit interest to zero, and then you'll see the increase in the land value, which we can do, no problem.
We have dug into it, and if you'd like, I think I can answer my own question to a certain extent. I think what's happening here is they've got a debit interest rate of 6% and a credit interest rate of 0.5%. And because they've straight-lined the infrastructure, and they've got the land purchase spread over the period to 2051, so the curve barely goes down below zero. There's barely any net borrowing in the whole thing, and then it starts kicking into profit. And when it comes into profit, you start getting credit interest. I think I'm on the right lines of how this works. And the reason why this is important is, well, not only because suddenly you've got a 200 or 300 million advantage on viability over the highest methodology, but I think it's quite difficult to explain this, but it's about when the developer takes his developer profit out. The developer profit is a cost. When you're doing a residual land valuation, the developer profit is a cost, and it's important when that cost comes out. And I think under the G.L. Hearn appraisal, that what you're doing is you're assuming that you borrow a small amount of money, I think it's 59 million or something in the first few years, you pay a bit of interest at 6% on that, then you go into credit and you put the money in the bank account and it stays earning 0.5% in the bank account until 2051, at which you pay it all out to the developer, and it's only then that the developer gets its profit. The problem with this is this is not the real world for development. As far as I know, there's not a developer capable of waiting till 2051 for his profit.
So are you saying then that the credit, the fact that finance cost appears as a credit is because that's exactly what happens, that the credit on the positive cash balance outweighs the debit on the negative.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Does that sound right to you, Mr. Sproul?
I'm not sure that is correct. There's a certain amount of accuracy in what you're saying with the straight line cancelling each other out in terms of debit and credit, but it's certainly not... more than the interest isn't more than the debit. I think what would help is if I provide more detail on this to explain it properly.
Thank you. Slightly to this point, which Mr. Sonnix has just made, infrastructure phasing is of interest in this viability analysis, to me at least. Your overall infrastructure figure, as I think you noted, is somewhere close to the highest number. But I believe, but would be great to get confirmation that the phasing is very different. So what I've done is I've looked at your infrastructure cost. I've increased it from 8,300 dwellings to 10,000 as a rough proxy to make it comparable with the highest one. So I've increased your infrastructure number. So that would make yours 640 million compared to the highest 673. These are figures with the 10% contingency and with professional fees as well, just so we're talking apples and apples. My calculations suggest that during... You both start the site at the same time, I think. So, again, I think we're sort of apples with apples. During the plan period, Hias have infrastructure of 340 million. And I believe you have infrastructure, as I said, scaled up for the number of dwellings, of 230 million. So you've got 32% less infrastructure than them in the early stages of the garden communities. I guess this is of interest to me for two reasons. One is there's obviously been a lot made about the principles of the garden communities and the importance of upfront infrastructure. But also, I forget whether you submitted a viability appraisal to the Uttlesford examination, but I do note the Uttlesford inspector's letter where they say there would be in the early years disproportionately high infrastructure costs. They say that this has not been factored into the viability analyses, and they say, therefore, we are concerned that the cost of interest from borrowing, and particularly peak debt, has not been factored in at an appropriate level. So they're saying slower infrastructure obviously significantly understates debt and interest.
We haven't carried out that same analysis. I'm a bit reserved about commenting on it without going through it myself. I think, again, we've deliberately gone with a simplistic approach to view all of this on a more high level rather than drilling down into the detail, given that we are setting policy as opposed to looking at the individual complexities of a development site.
But from what you said earlier, I understand you've essentially straight-lined the infrastructure.
Sorry, that's correct, costs. Yeah. So yeah. We have simplistically straight-lined the infrastructure costs and construction and income as well.
I would just observe that this obviously has implications for the statements that sensitivities at 250 DPA and a higher interest rate show a site to be viable, because if you haven't modelled your phasing in the way that you might and therefore you're not reflecting debt and interest correctly, then obviously your sensitivities will be quite different. Well, if you're not paying interest, it won't make a difference if you increase the interest rate.
Anybody else have questions for Mr. Sproul, please? Should we move on then and hear from Galliard? And Mr. Sproul isn't going anywhere, so if there's further questions that arise as a result of the other presentations and questioning we hear, I'm sure he'll come back with answers to them. So if I could turn to Mr. Brierley, is it? So now we're looking at the appraisal that's been done on behalf of Galliard by Gerald Eve. So would you like to explain the approach you've taken, please, Mr. Brown?
Thank you, sir. I just wanted to take a step back to explain how we got to our methodology and for us to think about what is the locus of viability in planning. A lot of the conversation we've had today actually play out across viability on small sites, big sites and so forth, and actually have influenced the way in which government has been addressing viability in the MPPF and MPG over the last few years. And there remains a daily question, I think, that from developers, to the extent reality is reflected in the way in which viability and planning is asked to look at things like land value and competitive returns. So, nevertheless, we have to look at this in the context of a planning guidance and policy. And that's quite important because we've heard a lot today about reality and things like that. And I think we just need to make sure that we are being consistent in the way we assess this in terms of how viability and planning and policy asks us to do so. And that takes me to my next point, which is I understand that this local plan is being assessed under the MPPF of 2012, which clearly is quite different in terms of the guidance that we've been provided in the 2019 or 18, whichever you prefer to call it, guidance we've got. And interestingly, I think a lot of the conversations today have sort of swung between the two types of methodology identified in both those documents. So again, I just thought I'd highlight that for the 2012 plan, we're asked to determine whether it's capable of being viable and deliverable, the cumulative impact of policies, but policies are not put there that create implementation at serious risk. That's serious risk, not at risk, and reasonable prospect of planning infrastructure is deliverable. They're all set out in the MPMPF, I think probably 175 to 178, something like that. I can get them exactly if you wish. And you could argue that the MPPF 2012 actually kicks viability slightly down the road when it comes to local plans and deals with it much more on a site-by-site basis, partly on the argument that we don't have the data at this moment in time, we'll deal with it at the moment when we do. I think the 2019 puts it very much at the front and centre of assessments at local plan, and indeed rather implies that you shouldn't need a viability assessment at a site-by-site basis because you should have done enough at the local plan level. Interestingly, I think the debates you're having over the last couple of days demonstrate the difficulties with that, and that probably we're still going to be doing the individual site assessments. So I suppose the first question I have is does the PPG, are we using PPG 14, which influences the 2012 guidance, or are we using NPG 2018-19 to determine what assumptions and how we best address viability? And that's quite important. There is an argument to say the MPG, the old PPG, has been replaced, and therefore we should look at it on the 2019 MPG, although have regard to the 2012 MPPF. And that does make it quite confusing. But I'll just give you some guiding factors on both, and then you can decide through your assessment which is the best one to look at all parts. PPG 14 says that evidence should be proportionate to ensure that plans are underpinned by a broad understanding of viability. That's paragraph 5 of the PPG 14. Viability assessment should be proportionate, but reflect the range of different developments, both residential and commercial, likely to come forward in an area, and need to deliver the vision of the plan. So again, very much focus on the sort of high level side of things, and that's paragraph 9. Paragraph 2 of the MPG 14 says there is no standard approach to viability, as we've, I think, been clearly demonstrated today. And it talks about a competitive return to a landowner and a developer. It talks about sufficiency and sufficient flexibility in the viability and the policies to enable that to be the case. And it also says it should be done on a current day basis, but forecasting may be considered. If we then look at the MPG 2019, that has tried very much to move away from the position that there are lots of different ways of doing it and has tried to standardise the approach to viability to, I think, very much help you as you're sitting there looking at how do I look at these different methodologies and bring them together to a single point. So there is actually more guidance in the MPG in 2019 about how to assess viability in planning, and less actually in the MPPF, which just says go and look at the guidance in the MPG. Viability in the MPG says viability must strike the balance between policy and landowners. That's paragraph 10. Reasonable return will be reflecting policy compliance, which, if you think it through, is actually core to the argument you've been having today about what are the implications on land value for applying policy, and which comes first, policy affecting land value or land value affecting policy. And I have to say, there's nothing new you've heard today in terms of the arguments that have been played out for at least the last 10 years on that. It actually identifies GDV as the metric that you should be using, a return on GDV for profit to a developer, and it rather puts that in as an assumption rather than an output, and identifies that the risk should be borne by the developer, and it's up to them in their return rates to account for that. And it says somewhere between 15 and 20% on GDV. I personally don't agree that's an appropriate way to do it, but that is what it says, and it talks about the plan when it's talking about that, rather than a site-specific development. Whether or not that is an appropriate one to do is open to debate, as you've heard today, and whether IRRs for large properties is a better one. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but that's what it says. Minimum land value to sell the land should comply with policy. So there it talks about minimum land values. And I think that's quite an interesting point as well, because if you're talking about a minimum land value, it doesn't really matter if land values inflate in the future or they don't. We're talking about a minimum position. And as long as that can be paid for now or in the future, then that will give us some guidance on what a benchmark should be. And then it talks about the proxy on land value should be existing use plus a premium, premium being that taking us up to a policy compliance. So we have a slight circularity in that, as I highlighted earlier, but just setting it out. So you can immediately see there are two sets of premises that we have to consider. It also talks about how do you deal with viability over time, and it rather implies it should be done on review mechanisms. It doesn't reference current day, doesn't reference growth or forecasting, so that will be open to interpretation as people go forward on that. So taking that on board, the methodology that we've tried to look at, and I put the, I know you're aware of this, but I'll just put the summation on our appraisal, is that we, at the time of doing it, and I also should mention that the time of doing all of this, clearly, a lot of the policies, or should I say the guidance on policy, has changed. And therefore, whilst evidence takes a while to come forward, you are going to have this crossover in terms of the reports and the information that you're using, whether it's using data and indications from 2012 or 2019. What we tried to do was we tried to present an appraisal which was consistent with Uttlesford, so that we had one appraisal that worked across both. And we tried to have regard to all the things I've just said to you in terms of guidance on how to do it. We saw our viability very much as a check and balance. We're not sitting here arguing the case in terms of structural evidence that to convince you that the policy should be, but rather compare and see whether or not we think that what has been presented from the council side is a reasonable for us going forwards, and I think we do. And our focus has very much been on whether it's been capable of being deliverable rather than absolutes. There's a positive difference it's positive for you to take away that there is a difference in approaches that have been presented to you, which is maybe an indication of the MPG 14. But they do all seem to be indicating there are different ways of doing the same thing, and there are various people around this table indicating that that would appear it's possible to be deliverable. So the methodology point that we're dealing with today, there does seem to be a various methodologies that indicate it could be deliverable. We have focused on a consistent approach, but we have tested a forecasting, albeit in accordance with PPG 14, we haven't sat down with the council and tried to agree the forecasting assumptions that we're using before we do it. And I think it says that in paragraph 14 for the very reasons you've heard today, that if you don't agree them, you're just having a debate about things that are very difficult to then test. We try to be transparent with the assumptions we've used, which is why we've used a plot by plot, as I call it, which is a unit by unit developer model rather than a master plan model, because that is consistent with assessing it against other schemes that are going on. Although I do appreciate a lot of large schemes, including a lot of worked on and other people around this table have worked on that have been referenced over the last few days, are done on a master developer approach and are done on IRR, but we focused on that approach. We used the current day return on GDV, indicating on the 2019 whether that was appropriate or not. We did it because, in our experience, that is where local authorities, when assessing schemes, tend to go at this moment in time for the very reasons I've explained. But we've also allowed for the affordable housing at a lower return, which gave us the blended rate of 18%. We did identify in the appraisal that that gave us an outcome in IRR terms of about 16%. And that would give you a land value outcome of £165,000 net gross acre. That's including stamp duty and so forth, or £175,000 if you just have it as a gross, which was above our benchmark value of £100,000 an acre, which meant we had roughly about £92 million worth of surplus. And I reference that because you've talked about contingencies and where that money should go. Our view is that, I'm sure you'll ask me some questions in a minute, but whilst we've allowed for different things in different categories, we effectively have an ability to increase in costs by £92 million and still be in a viable position against the benchmark that we have chosen, which, again, is higher than the council's. So we felt that, that was capable of being viable, and whether the money moved around between different pots didn't really matter. We had that ability. The finance rate, we've used the standard consistent approach that's been used on viability assessments in planning. So we use a 6.5%, 100% debt finance, no credit rating. I think that probably gets me to... gets me to a summation, at least, and allows you to ask me some questions.
Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you. Thank you very much. So if you could, first of all, turn to my table, page 4 of the agenda. I've taken the site area figure of 1325 acres from your material and worked out that that's 536 hectares. I've said that you're proposing to build, that your assessment is on the basis of building 10,000 dwellings, that the infrastructure per unit allowance of 51,000, excluding professional fees and contingency. Contingency comes in at 5% in your assessment, doesn't
yes.
it?
Yes. References 5%, as I say, there is, as I say, because there's a surplus, you have the opportunity to yes. to soap up more.
Yeah. Okay. And professional fees you've allowed for at 8%, haven't you?
I have, yes.
And the land value comes out as residual. It's a residual land value comes out as an output of the model. I think the figure I've got there in my table
170,
is slightly
right.
different from the one you gave. Is it?
The number you have in there is the number in the appraisal. I gave 175 off the top of my head, but there are two numbers. The 170 represents the gross number, so that effectively includes stamp duty and
right.
fees. When you exclude those, it goes down to 165. There is a reference in the report as a footnote you might find. I can find the page number if you like, or I can get the page
number. That's all right. I can look that up. That's okay.
Actually, I can see it, sorry. It's on page 8, and it says 162. My apologies.
So 162 is the net?
It's the equivalent, I think, of the other ones, yeah.
Okay. So your 92 million surplus is based on which figure, the 770 or the 162?
Well, they're the same figure. I suppose it's based on the gross, so it doesn't take off the stamp duty.
Yeah.
It's based on what £100,000 would be.
100,000.
So I've just taken the 70,000 effectively and multiplied it by
70,000 break a gross up to the site, to the full site area. Yeah. Okay. Can I just ask about the land area that your appraisal dealt with? So it's an area, as I understand it, within both Braintree and Uttlesford districts.
Yes, it is based off a measured plan that WYG did, which I believe was submitted to you as part of the YG overall submissions, which was a master plan which took on board all of the various bits presented in the numerics and created an image from it, which we then used so that we were sure that the amount of area that we were assessing could deliver everything you needed, including all the open space and so forth, rather than taking a number of units and multiplying them up by a net to gross ratio to give you an area.
Sure. Yeah. So it's taken from the WYG master plan, which I have.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fine. Thank you. And is all that area subject to option agreements?
No. So of it, I think we have 181 hectares or 477 acres. I can't tell you off the top of my head what the breakdown is between Braintree and Uttlesford, but I can tell you that it's about 70-30 split, I think, of the of the area is on Uttlesford. So most of our area that is under control by Galliard sits in Uttlesford, but there's still a reasonable proportion in real terms of land inside Braintree. What is quite useful, I suppose, is that the amount of units we're talking about and the amount of area that we're talking about is not that dissimilar to highest at 10,000 units. So it's relatively comparable for numerics rather than geography.
I see that. And is there overlap between the area you've assessed and the area assessed by Hearn for ANSC?
There will be crossover, yes. Yeah. Yes. I haven't got... We could... If you want to overlay a plan on the top of each other, but they won't be that dissimilar.
Probably do that myself. Yeah.
Yeah. I think they've excluded our land, but we haven't excluded theirs, if you like.
Yes. Yeah. I see. Okay, and what about the profiling of infrastructure costs and build costs and land purchase costs in your appraisal?
Most of it is programmed as you sort of walk down the road. So you're buying land, you're building the houses, and you're selling the houses. So it's a domino conveyor belt effect to those parts. Mm-hmm. Off-site infrastructure is up front over a period of a few years, I think 2-3 years. Be 4 years, actually 48 months. So our off-site infrastructure, what you need to get onto the site is up front, and then we're assuming that you lay the pipes and roads and so forth as you go down.
Right. Okay. And what about land purchase?
Land purchase as you need it. In my experience, a question Semi asked to my colleague over here was, would we anticipate it to be purchased as you go along? The size of the site we're talking about and the tax implications for landowners and also for developers in terms of outgoings, you would usually have some sort of agreement with the landowner in terms of what the price would be and the drawdown profile, and then you would draw down as you need it to best cash flow that for both parties. So the way we've done that is we've assumed the amount of land that you would need in order to do a proportion of development and have just profiled that through the development.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Right.
Just maybe as a reference point for comparison, if you included professional fees and contingency, we'd be around about 53.7 I think, per unit compared to the 51. And if you added in the excess, and I accept the point on the stamp duty, I'm doing high level, we'd be around about 63. So in other words, we would say that the scheme could support costs up to £63 million per unit. Sorry, 63 grand a unit. Yeah. That would be quite impressive. Yeah. I'll have to get some of that in my bank account. And still be viable based on £100,000 an acre. Arguably, that would go down slightly because of the stamp duty point that you raised. Mm.
Okay. Sensitivities. Did you do any sensitivity analysis?
We did a bit. Yes. We did do a growth sensitivity as a test. I wouldn't enforce that was the way I would anticipate it to come forward. We have very much relied upon a current day. We did test the sensitivity, and we have done the standard sensitivities you do of values and costs going up and down a little bit.
But you haven't presented those. You've only presented the...
We may have presented them in a sensitivity table. Yes, we did on page 9. We did the sensitivity, but then we did the growth model as well.
Yes, I beg your pardon. Yes, it's the summary of outputs in terms of land values.
So that's a basic one we're sort of advised by the RSS to do, which is looking at the implications of revenue increase and bill cost increase. So it's relatively simplistic, but what it represents is the land value outcome and shows what would happen if costs went up by 5% and same and down and the same with the sales.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Okay. Does anyone have questions for Mr. Brierley, please?
Thank you. On your infrastructure contingency, I may simply be misreading the table, but I saw an infrastructure contingency of 10 million, which I forget if you said you were using a 5% or 10% infrastructure contingency, but 10 million seemed lower than either of those. But I ask just for clarification, as I may have been misreading the table.
Well, I think you may be reading the appraisal.
Yes, I think that's what I was looking at, yeah.
And that shows that we've made an allowance of 5% on infrastructure contingency. So that is 10.5 million that we've got in there, yes.
When you say appraisal,
you mean the appraisal summary, or do you mean...
it won't include it on Section 106 items. It will be on infrastructure items.
Oh, yeah, I've got it, yeah. So...
I see, okay. So you're saying...
I appreciate the numbers in comparison are lower than other people's contingency references. But in our experience, the 51,000 was consistent with other major developments in terms of the infrastructure costs. So, it was in the initial document that came with the appendix. on page 13, where I make reference to we think that a 5% on the infrastructure would be acceptable, but I recognise that there's various other contingencies being considered.
Yeah. So it's five. If I may carry on briefly. So it's 5% on, I guess, off-site infrastructure.
But it'll be on physical infrastructure rather than Section 106.
So nothing on Section 106. 5% on off-site.
Yeah. Okay. That's the way we presented it. I can't sit down and break that out for you, but sure. That is how it's done.
Okay. And then just on the phasing of infrastructure, so you offered some helpful comments over sort of off-site, more front-loaded, the rest phased. I just did a calculation, again, believing you start in a similar date to Hias. I did a calculation looking at how much infrastructure you deliver in the plan period and how much you deliver overall relatively. So, again, this is with contingency, Hias being the 10% contingency. Yours is a bit lower, of course. And based on the same delivery rates. So does 230 million during the plan period sound about correct for infrastructure phasing?
I'm afraid I'd have to go away and look at the numbers to give you a confirmation on that. Happy to do that if that would help the inspector, but I don't know. What I can tell you is that all the off-site infrastructure was weighted over the first effectively 4 years, and we weighted it on the way you do it in Argos. You can create a weighting, so it's like a triangle. So if you imagine all of the construction off-site is done over the 4 years, and you do a triangle like that, you get more in the first couple of years than you do in the latter years. I'm happy to show, but I can't. Off the top of my head, I don't know the answer to your question.
Sure. In case it's useful for reference, I had 230 in the plan period versus 340 for Hias, and I had 530 across the whole period versus 673 for Hias. So that's with the contingency, 10% for Hias, and with professional fees as well.
Sorry, just run those again. So if you do Hias is first.
Hias plan period 340.
340.
Hias total 673.
673, yeah.
Yours, I calculated, is 228 in the plan period.
228, yeah.
And 530 total.
Okay. Contingency that looks about the same. Might be a little bit less.
Yes, I calculated you had 33 in pound million. I calculated you had 33% less infrastructure during the plan period, and 21% less overall.
It's probably not that useful as a comparison because obviously we've got infrastructure in Uttersford. So actually, if you're completely just comparing like for like, it would be lower again. If it was invited, we could do an appraisal which represented only Braintree, and then we could run. I wouldn't change the assumptions, and we could run it just to see what it looked like.
I'll consider whether I need any more information like that. Just to check, did you pro rata the number of dwellings in the two appraisals? Oh, no, they're both 10,000.
They're both 10,000.
Both 10,000, yeah. Just I don't know which items of infrastructure are required. I mean, I'm assuming that in the case of Hias, they will have thought about what infrastructure they need, whereas in Uttersford they will need other things. So to do a like for like.
Yeah, understood. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry, can I ask one more question, actually?
Yeah, by all means.
Sorry. Yep. The interest cost was quite a bit lower than the highest interest cost. I think it was about 20 million debit.
I checked that while you were asking the question earlier. Yes, it's about 22 million debit. I suspect a lot of that is to do with the way we've actually structured the land rather than the weightings that have been put on it. Again, I think with those sort of things, if it was helpful that we had a set of assumptions that the inspector wanted everyone to test against in terms of cash flow, that would give you a comparable basis. But yeah, our interest is definitely lower than you said 90, I think, or something to that order.
I think yours was 22 and Hias have 266 million under their 10% scenario.
Yeah.
And your... Sorry.
No,
You mentioned a benchmark rate. I think you had in your report 100 to 150k range rather than 100,000.
We used 100 as our base position. What we did is gave a range because that's what the previous positions, and also we have to think about how we compare that to the Uttersford and what was being presented at Uttersford.
Sure.
So that's the range, and again, it's whether or not we're talking about a minimum land value to release it for market or such. And I would anticipate each piece of land will be bought at different prices, as we were talking about earlier, and some will be lower and some will be higher, and that was the general range. My personal view is that a minimum of £100,000 would be a reasonable place in an option agreement to start debates. It may not be the position that most. I think we've had this conversation in previous times, and it may not be the position taken by others.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. My query really was the looking for a bit of an explanation regarding the difference between residual land value per acre that Gellids have identified of 170,000 and the 113,000 for the Andrewsfield Consortium and Countryside, given that there is overlap between.
Well, again, they're both outputs of residual, so if there's any variation in the assumptions that they're inputting into those appraisals, they will result in a different position, and I think we heard there was a different position on the way interest rates were, which will affect it, and also the structure of those items. I think, I might be wrong, you might want to come in on this, I think generally in terms of what the benchmark land value is, we're probably not inconsistent of what an appropriate level should be for planned discussions. In terms of how that's come about in a different number, that is simply different numbers, different inputs.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly understand why the different outputs have come as a result of the different inputs that have been employed. That's not surprising that that's been the case. Yeah, Mr. Sonnox.
Yes, I wanted to ask whether the option you have already over some of the land allows for deferred purchase over the period to 2050, whatever it is that your project goes out to.
I can't really discuss the commerciality of an option agreement, and in viability terms, we shouldn't really be doing that anyway. We should be looking at what a reasonable landowner could do. If my client was here, and he gave me the nod, I could tell the answer to that. I don't think it's a problem because we did it in accordance with what we were allowed to do against our commerciality. So obviously the option's not going to last until 2052, but we would anticipate we'd have built out our section way before the end of the development.
Can I follow that up, sir?
Yes.
Yes, because this phasing of land purchase goes right to the root of the viability and changes the figures entirely if you bring it up front. So, you know, if we're trying to show the plan is deliverable, we can look at rules and regulations, but if we don't control the land, it's not going to be deliverable.
Okay, if the question is can we do phased payments of land, the answer is yes to that. If that is your question. If your question is can we do that all over the plan period, or not over the plan period, but over the development of the garden village, no, the option doesn't go that long, but we don't need it to go as long as that in any event. We're not, the option agreement we have is not for an upfront payment. In fact, I think that I don't need to go into the commercialities, but they're positive for what we're doing. We can deliver it on the basis of what we have. It does assume that everyone else will obviously, other land would be on the same basis, but I think that's a reasonable landowner assumption. It's again looking at the difference between the practicalities of commerciality and reality and what you're supposed to do for viability and planning. And I think we've done the latter consistently whilst having regard to the commercialities of our own deal.
Any other questions for Mr. Brierley? If not, we can move on to No, if not, we can... The assessment that's done on behalf of L&Q, Cirrus and G120. That's Savills. And... Who's speaking to that one?
Louis.
That's right.
Yes.
Thank you.
Perfect. So I'll just start by saying we've prepared an Excel model over an Argus appraisal. This was to give us a bit more flexibility in test key inputs, outputs, and also speed up the process, because I think I probably still would be inputting it now if I was doing an Argus appraisal. The Excel appraisal adopts a residual land value approach using a profit margin. And in terms of the business plan of the model, it's a day one unserviced sale to a house builder consortium, whereby they'll install all the infrastructure and sell off all the units. In my experience of similar projects to this, there's always different approaches of you're looking at it from a master developer perspective, even if you've got your house builder hat on, or conversely, you're looking at building out all the units or permutations of the two. In all the 20 so appraisals I've done, every single one's been different. So we felt this delivery model was a suitable place to start and reasonable for the purposes of viability at this early stage. In terms of the profit margin, we've adopted 27.5% on GDV. Now, most PLC house builders will be targeting 18 to 20% operating margin at PLC level. Therefore, their assets need to make in excess of this after you take off overhead costs, corporate financing costs, and so on. The margin differential between that and the 27.5% also will allow them to make a master developer profit if they do wish to go from one bookend to the other and sell off all the parcels. We also think this reflects the current unknowns of the project. For example, infrastructure cost, phasing, land drawdown mechanism, and effectively acts as an additional contingency if you wanted to look at it that way instead. In terms of the land drawdown, it's paid all up front with no deferment. As mentioned earlier, on other option sites, typically the delivery model is to draw it down and phase it. and in other agreements, you might have a minimum land value that is index linked to something like CPI and RPI. But again, we felt this was too much of an unknown to make an assumption around this, so we went for a conservative base case approach in terms of all up front. As land is drawn down and appraised day one, it means there's less focus on other assumptions such as absorption, phasing of infrastructure, phasing of land drawdown, and as discussed earlier, inflation, discount rates and interest rates. These type of assumptions are perhaps easy to evidence looking backwards, but almost impossible to predict looking forwards, which then means there's more focus on the easier to predict inputs, easier in inverted commas, revenue, costs, density, etc. Moving on to finance. Finance is applied to 100% of costs at 6% effective interest rate per annum, and this is paid current. It was mentioned earlier that this rate may be seen low, but it seems that other people are in conjunction of where we are with the 6%. In my experience on other sites, you've got the corporate house builders with a cheaper cost of capital because they're using their balance sheet facilities and they might be borrowing at 3%. And then you've got people using project financing, which may be up to 8%, 9%, but only on 60% of cost. So 6% feels another conservative assumption. In terms of inflation, this model adopts no inflation going forwards because the land's being drawn down up front, and therefore it would be unfair to include all the additional potential upside of inflation going back to the landowners. In our experience, it's typically more the master developers who will adopt an inflation-led approach due to they see the impact of placemaking, they want to see the benefit of sales uplift, and they are selling the land down over time. We also, so this produced a residual land value at the bottom of the appraisal. We then also run this through a parallel model, assuming it was purchased by a master developer at the same price, and with some inflation in, does it produce a comparable return to be for them to be competitive in that situation as well? In terms of other assumptions, we've got 10% professional fees on construction costs and then a 5% contingency on construction costs plus professional fees. Sales and marketing doesn't seem a contentious point throughout this process. And I think that covers most of it. Thank you.
Thanks very much. So if I can just run through my questions then. First of all, my table, page 4 of the agenda. I had to calculate the site area you'd assumed back from your residual land value figure. So I hope I've got that right.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Sorry, we're tag teaming this. You were almost correct. It's actually 703 as opposed to 704.
I stand corrected.
Apologies.
That's fine.
It is in the Appendix 2 of our submission, which is the land use budget.
Oh, right, OK. Sorry, I didn't get that.
But apologies, yes, it probably wasn't.
Didn't spot that. Appendix 2, land use budget, yeah. OK, so that's a lot. That's obviously a smaller area than the one assessed by Hire. So that presumably reflects the fact this is your client's holdings that you're assessing here.
Yeah, that's correct. So so our clients actually have that land holding under a single entity at the moment. My understanding is, unless I'm corrected very quickly, that there is the possibility of acquiring additional land, which would bring it up to the 21,000 assessed by Hire. But for the purposes of this viability, we've just looked at what we can actually deliver with no impediment.
So it's 17,000 dwellings on the 703 hectare
site? Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. And what's the position as regards control of that land?
So again, I'm looking to my right in case someone runs over very quickly. My understanding is that that's all under one particular entity and is able to be delivered with no further additional land to be acquired. There is additional land that could be acquired that is subject to various memorandum of understandings and agreements that are currently being undertaken.
So under one entity, do you mean an option agreement or?
Excuse me, Andrew from Savills. Yeah, so the 17,000 is controlled through a single promotion agreement, and there are additional elements of land which are currently sort of within legals, which would be in addition to that, but that is not the basis of which we've modelled. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. You've modelled on the basis of a build-out rate of 354 per annum, I think, haven't you?
Yes, that's correct.
Average, of course.
That's an average.
Yeah.
We have also done a sensitivity at 250, which we can publish the results of, if you wish.
You haven't given me those as yet, have you?
I don't think we've published it externally. No.
Okay, and in terms of infrastructure, your colleagues explained the profit rate you've applied and the basis on which that was arrived at. Infrastructure, I've put the figure on the table there, 45711, which I think I've taken directly from your summary of assumptions. 45711 per unit, including contingency and professional fees?
Yeah, so in our original submission, at Appendix 5, we provide some detail as to what those infrastructure costs are.
Yep.
There's also a slight differential in terms of the contingency and professional fees rates that have been applied to those infrastructure costs.
Yep.
So I think one of the themes that has been apparent this morning is that there does tend to be separate costs and separate contingencies split out into strategic and construction.
Yeah.
So we've applied... Let me just check. 7.5% professional fees on the strategic infrastructure costs and a 10% contingency.
7.5% professional fees and 10% contingency on strategic infrastructure?
Yeah, the strategic infrastructure. That's correct.
Is that clearly set out in your one of your appendices?
Yeah, this, in Appendix 5, it says the actual breakdown of the costs, and I can't remember which page within the actual report
right,
it gives it a breakdown.
I can find that. Okay. Land value per acre... I've taken that, I think, from your... Yes, that's that's the figure that appears in, at the end of your... excuse me. The end of your appraisal, isn't it? Which I then had to gross back up to get the hectareage. So that's taken directly from your appraisal. And that's the output. That's an output figure, having assumed all the costs... Having applied all the cost assumptions and the profit rate and so on.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, okay. Could you just explain a bit more about your option two? And I think, am I right, there's actually an option three as well?
You know more than me.
Well, maybe not.
So option two...
Tell me about option two first, and then we'll find out whether there's an option three or not. Tell me a bit more about the difference between option one and option two.
So option one is the house builder approach,
yep.
All units built out.
Yep.
Option two is the master developer approach, but adopting the residual land value that came out of the house builder appraisal and looks at them selling off every single plot of service land. We've then looked at what the output profit metrics are for them as a master developer to get comfortable that the 27.5% profit on GDV means that there's enough embedded profit to make a return as a master developer as well. The only difference between that appraisal is we've included growth up until the point service parcels are sold. Now, because it's not clear about the parceling up of certain plots, there's kind of four lumpy phases that we've assumed. Now, the inflation's only applied up until the point that each phase is sold, and then it's deferred in kind of 30 to 40 million chunks per annum over time, but the price is locked in at the point each phase is sold. So in terms of the inflation we adopted in that, it was 3% on house price and 2.75% on build cost, and that also applies it to infrastructure.
So what you've done there is you've so that isn't a residual land value valuation then that second that option two appraisal. Am I
yeah.
right?
It's not, a separate appraisal, it's the approach we took to making sure that the output of option one seems sensible. Okay, based on a completely different delivery model, well, the two bookends effectively.
Yes,
but the output we submitted was from the option one.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. You have to dig in quite a way to find option two, don't you?
Yeah.
But in option two, the land value coming out of option one is an input.
Is an input, yeah.
So what's the output? What's
the output,
key output? Is it profit on cost?
Yeah, profit on cost is at 20%, and your unlevered IRR is 8%, and your return on capital employed is 18%.
20% sounds suspiciously round, so that's definitely not input.
Let me
that's an output, is it? Definitely
let
not
me
input.
Expose some decimal points. 20.48%.
Yeah, so I think that probably answers my question about option three, because I'd misunderstood that option two was an alternative residual valuation.
Okay.
I thought there was another one that was doing what you've just described, but in fact what you described is option two. So,
yeah.
So that explains my confusion. Right, okay. Thanks. Right, any questions around the table for... it's Mr. Sargent, is it? Got you the right way around, yeah, Mr. Sargent.
Yes, talked about a promotion agreement. Could we ask the question of whether that allows for the phasing of land over the project period again? I think this one's till 2069.
Yes. Yes, it does.
And then moving on, we've really struggled with your... tables. There's nearly 200 pages of tables at the back of the report, and we were unable to relate them back to the option one and option two appraisals. In particular, we've got 95 million of interest in the option one appraisal, which we don't know how it's calculated. We don't know what the infrastructure phasing assumption, and even more importantly than that, we don't know what the developer profit phasing assumption is in it. But we do know that that compares with 593 million of interest under the highest appraisal. And so, you know, a lot of the viability in this model, really a serious number, is coming from the difference in the interest calculation. We would ask if we can see it, and if we can't see it, can you explain what the nearly 500-odd million difference is?
I'll try and explain it as well as I can over the microphone. So I guess the key difference between highest and us is the difference approaching income and build cost. If you take a master developer appraisal, it's quite chunky in terms of your sales receipts coming in, whereas in house builder model, after the first 14 years in this, it becomes self-financing because you put in most of the infrastructure. And there will be periods where there's still negative cash balances and interest will apply to that. But to be honest with you, I think most of the interest cost is covered in the first 14 years. In terms of the phasing, it's broken down into four phases, and these are done on a straight line basis, just due to the level of information at this kind of stage. You've got phase one, which we'll say is 182 million, which is from Jan 22 over an 84-month period. You've got phase two, which is 247 million from Jan 29, so it runs straight afterwards, over a 132-month period. Then you've got 108 million. From Jan 40 over an 84-month period, and then finally you've got 237 from Jan 47 over quite a long period of 275 months. I heard earlier that the interest, sorry,
just to, so that that's your total infrastructure spend, is it?
Yeah. And I think, as mentioned earlier, the developer margin is higher because there is less known about the phasing and absorption of sites like this. And as we said, it effectively acts as an additional contingency if there was any changes to that phasing.
I'm assuming that that includes the 30% affordable, but I wondered if it was also local authority policy compliant on the tenure splits, as in 80-20.
Yeah, so, sorry, that was a bit loud.
We've adopted 30% affordable, and we have had mind of the sort of 60-40 split. The percentage of open market value, I think, was raised in the submission that is quite high. However, we're also very mindful of the fact that the affordable housing policy is continuing to change, so we've set it at a relatively high level because at this stage we consider it to be appropriate. Obviously, it will be tested as we move through the development process, and once it goes to an outline planning stage, we'll then assess it at the policy compliant level then.
So just to be clear, so it's 30% affordable housing in your appraisal, with a split within that of 60-40 between
affordable rent and intermediate.
So that's on the 2012 MPPF definitions, is it?
Yes. Sorry, I could model it with the wider definitions of affordable housing, but I think we could be here for a lot longer.
Thank you.
Sorry, I wanted to come back on this business of developer profit, which I think is really, really important in the real world. And what I'm suspecting from having tried to reproduce your cash flows without having the cash flows is that you only get anywhere near that lower interest charge if the developer profit as a cost is only charged right at the end again. And the question has to be whether you have any developer prepared to wait before taking any dividend out of this project until somewhere around 2040, 2050, 2069 is the end of the project. My experience is that developers want to see some profit out of it within 10 years. And the question is this real to be talking about developers waiting that long? And I want to emphasise again, this literally makes hundreds of millions of difference to the interest charge.
I can confirm that developer profit is taken out along the journey. So the way the model's set up is it's a residual model whereby land is, that effectively creates a circular reference, so profit becomes the output after you put in the target. So it's not I put in a cost of however many millions, billions perhaps in this instance, of developer profit at the end. It's taken out along the journey when I've got positive net cash flows. So that's just to confirm that point. Developers will be able to take profit out of this as they go. They'll have significant negative net assets in the first few years, whereby they've bought the land and put in lots of infrastructure. But that will change as you go.
Sir, would it be appropriate to ask if they could give us that cash flow? Because at the moment, I'm very doubtful of that interest charge.
It is there, unfortunately, it is there in the sort of 200-odd pages of the appendices, and we can try and provide a simplified version of the cash flow, but the nature of the model is unfortunately a very complicated model. And in the interest, we have tried to provide everything, but we will try and look at providing a simplified cash flow.
Again, don't provide it until I've asked for it, because I'll need to go away and think about all this and come back with the things I need. So what you're saying is that if I look hard enough in the spreadsheets I've got, I will see a line saying what? Developer profit, what will I see? What do I need to look for to see the developer profit coming out?
What page is that? There's a summary tab in the appendix where there's a line that says profit pre-tax. That's effectively your net cash flow line. Above it, there's a finance line. So if I was looking at this and wanted to work out how the interest charge is calculated, I'd take all my top revenue lines on a per annum basis. I'd take all my cost lines down to the legal fees per unit line, all the way up to the land one. I'd work out what the net cash flow is at the bottom. And if it's negative, I'd roll that forward and make it cumulative. So any new cumulative negative cash balance, I'd apply my 6% to. Any positive cash balance, I'd apply 0% to. And I'd run that through the duration of the cash flow. The only nuance is this is an output on an annual basis of the cash flows, which is on a monthly basis. So it might not come to exactly the same answer, but it should help you get your head around the calculation basis.
So the profit pre-tax, then. I'm looking at the summary tab, option one. Am I looking in the right place? Summary tab, option one. Cash flow summary.
That's
house builder.
That line gives you the answer about when profit's taken out.
Starting in 2020. So 2022, profit pre-tax, negative 230.7.
Yeah, that's right.
That's what... Is that millions or? That's millions, is it?
Yeah.
2023, 57.5.
5.6, 6.8.
Debit. And then in 2024, you go into the black, 5.6 million positive.
Yeah. So that line answers the when developer profit question is taken out. In terms of calculating the interest line, which is the finance line above that line,
yeah,
I've just explained that you'd take all your revenue, you take all your costs up to that finance line, you'd add the two together, you'd work out what your cumulative cash flow is, you'd apply the interest rate to any negative balance in a year at 6%, and then that should give you a circa 90 to 100 million pound finance cost. And as I mentioned earlier, I think it takes 14 years for the project to get its capital back out, i.e. for it to break even. So there's circa 14 years of interest cost.
But within those first 14 years, you're still taking profit out, presumably, because you're going to the black within 2 years.
Yeah.
And how much comes out as profit?
Whatever's left over.
So 5.6 in year 2024 comes out or not?
It's not held in the project per se.
Right. Okay.
I can decide as developer. I can decide if I want to leave that profit in the project and recycle it to minimise my interest costs,
sure,
which I perhaps will do in the early years, depending on my corporate situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or I may need to pay a dividend out or use it elsewhere.
Uh-huh.
So there's not an implicit assumption.
You want to come back on that, Mr. Sonnix?
Yes, what I'm hearing is that they pressed the button in Argus Developer to enable to take profit to be taken out early. So I can only assume that this very low interest charge comes from low infrastructure. We've got a whole load of, and perhaps for later questions, got a whole load of infrastructure items that are left out of this appraisal. Biggest, of course, being the assumption that it can be built before the roads are done. And then there's a whole series of other ones that they've only got 777 million of infrastructure costs, very little contingency and so on added on top of that. So we're still mystified about the interest charge. We're trying to look at why it is they can go cash positive so quickly when all the other appraisals are showing that it's a big number.
What's your question about? Just what order we do these things?
Possibly it neatly ties. It's on infrastructure phasing.
Right.
Sorry, I have two questions. One on infrastructure phasing and one on profit. But not timing of extraction, more on sort of percentage of profit and so on.
Do you want to ask your profit question then? And then I think, because we can come back to infrastructure all in one go.
Sure.
Yep.
I noticed that on profit... developer profit, you have an assumption towards the upper end of the range used by private sector developers, and I was quite interested to read a broader Savills report on this. In fact, I referred to it in my own consultation response. It talks at length and with significant evidence on higher required profit for more complicated
sites, which I think makes a lot of sense. I just wondered if you could talk about this briefly, because it seems like a very important point and one that you've, regardless of phasing and extraction of profit, certainly you've reflected in your own appraisal higher profit as a requirement for more complicated sites like this.
That is a historic report that you're asking me to speak about. In terms of the profit levels, it needs to properly incentivise someone to take on the risk associated with the project of this scale, which is why it's at the upper end. There seems to be a lot of queries or questions around finance, phasing, infrastructure. As I alluded to earlier, the 7.5% differential between what some of the other colleagues in the room have looked at as a margin assumption compared to the 27.5%. 7.5% of GDV in this scenario is probably going to be around £360 million in terms of additional costs that you may have in the appraisal that comes into it, or finance going up because you're looking at rephasing it. So this is why it's been set at the higher range, bearing in mind a lot of these unknowns and not wanting to get too focused on finance, phasing and infrastructure. It's just a slightly different methodology of applying loads of contingencies to your costs and then bringing your margin down. But both will give you the same answer as we're seeing.
Okay, so you're saying generally more complex projects require higher profit assumptions, and you also look at things like return on capital employed, I note in your report as well. I think you said you came out at 18%, and that was sort of at the lower end, but within a range of in the report I referred to, for example.
Yeah, I think if you benchmark strategic land, it's very hard to benchmark it against other asset classes, and there's not a lot of comping that you can do in terms of IRRs, but you obviously can do return on capital employed because these get published. I think if you look at it in terms of an IRR methodology, it's not a safe real estate investment class, which you might be getting 6 to 7% from, and it's not necessarily high-risk, high-rise development in London where people are targeting 15% plus. So it kind of falls into the middle. There's always been that range, and there's never a correct answer in terms of what's being targeted. So that's why we always focus on the profit methodology approach, but sense-checking the outputs that come out of it. But typically, you can get those metrics up through business planning, phasing of land drawdown, so on and so forth. So there are definitely things that we sense check to make sure it's working on in terms of all metrics, so we don't just look at one in isolation, and they are mentioned in that report.
Can I turn to Mr. Spilsbury?
Thank you, sir. Just heard helpfully from Savills that there's an expectation that profit will be drawn down, and there'll be a necessity to do that over the course of a scheme of this scale. Maybe not straight away, but certainly over time, which is broadly consistent with the highest approach, which obviously does allow profit as a cost over time. The reasons being, well, Mr. Sargent mentioned dividend, but clearly also there'll be need to allow for developers working capital, overhead and profit, future land purchases, etc. Now, it's useful to note that within the Savills appraisal, that's been costed for, either as presumably a cost which has finance applied to if it's taken out at a point at which there's negative cash flow balance, or as was mentioned, on the basis of wherever there's positive cash flow balances occurring throughout the scheme. So my question was actually to the other promoters, so Jill Hearn and Gerald Eve, where we've heard that in the case of Jill Hearn's appraisal, there's actually a positive finance charge of £30 million, and in Gerald Eve's appraisal, so Jill Hearn's appraisal, positive finance charge of £30 million, Gerald Eve's appraisal equates to about £22.4 million, so much less in comparison to Savills, which is circa £90 million. Some big differences. Hyas is obviously much higher again. So how is the cost of profit allowed for in the Jill Hearn and Gerald Eve appraisals for the other Garn communities? Is that having an influence on where the finance costs are sitting for those? Thank you.
Would you like to tackle that, gentlemen? Mr. Briley first, perhaps?
Sure. I suppose it creates a secondary question, which I'll leave for everyone to think about, which is whether or not the risk profile changes for a developer at the beginning of the development compared to the end. If we're talking something of this size, is it very fair that a developer at the beginning gets the same return to the developer at the end? And what I'm saying there is that I would say the risk profile reduces over the lifetime of a scheme like this. When you get to the last couple of parcels, there's no infrastructure to do. You know, they know the price, everything's there. They've got the lovely community facilities and roads and so forth, and so they could pay a very high price, either on land or through return on profit if the land was fixed. And as such, you would get you could argue their profit return would increase versus the person at the beginning who's paying out all the stuff and has a low profit return. So how do you manage that in a viability and planning world? How do you ensure that you've been fair to the person at the beginning as well as the person at the end in terms of your profit return? And the way I look at that is that you provide a profit return on the whole overall, rather than trying to break it up into parcels and provide a return at appropriate points. Because you'll start arguing about what the right return should be at the end versus at the beginning. And the way we've done it is we've got a singular return over the entirety of development. Yes, it will be reflective of the end, like any other viability assessment usually is. But what it means is that the viability and the profit return is basically being shared across the entirety of development, and therefore the risk profile is reflecting both the upside at the end and the downside at the beginning.
Mr. Sproul.
Yes, we would provide a similar explanation that the 20% profit margin implies the risks of the entire project and applies towards the end of the appraisal. With regards to the debit interest, as I explained earlier, it was it's a nuance of the appraisal that figure isn't listed in the appraisal, but deducted from the land value, which we can provide a more definitive amount for.
Sorry, sir, the other question on the interest point from us, obviously I don't think it would be, it's that relevant to compare Mark's Tay to Braintree in terms of size and the outcomes of the interest amount. Yes, in terms of how we've already explained how we've done the interest, but the actual sum will clearly be different between the models because they're different sites.
Any follow-up questions on those points? Mr. O'Connell?
I wonder if the developers who've just commented made those comments would also comment on, I guess this is what I was getting at earlier, would also comment on the impact on interest cost, this differential we're talking, I mean, it's huge between Hyas and the other developers, of having significantly lower infrastructure. In the case of Gerald Eve, significantly lower infrastructure total, and in the case of Geo Hearn, much lower, and phasing. And in the case of Geo Hearn, predominantly lower phasing, i.e. much less infrastructure up front. Because, of course, in the case of Gerald Eve, for example, this makes the Gerald Eve appraisal, this makes a huge amount of difference. You have no additional positive cash flow, but you're spending another, in the highest model, another $143 million on infrastructure, most of that earlier phased. So you think you're applying 6% a year to that, you're not paying any of it back, you're compounding the interest on that. This is a huge source of the differential. There may also be an impact from profit, timing, slight difference in models and so on. But I wonder if they could comment on the fact that, you know, having this much lower infrastructure in the model really impacts the interest cost significantly.
So this is by comparison with the Hearn and Gerald Eve models vis-a-vis HIAS?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I think the simple thing is, if you look, our infrastructure costs are not different in the base position. It's on the contingency allowances. And if you have a 40% contingency on top of your infrastructure costs, you clearly are going to have more interest. My advice from the cost consultants who looked at it and the evidence of other schemes is we don't require that significant amount of compounded contingency. And I think that's probably the primary difference, because you look at the numbers, otherwise you wouldn't be able to explain it. And I don't think we are, I mean, I appreciate it's still £100 million, which is quite a lot of money, but it's not, as a proportion, it's not significantly out. And I think it's predominantly down to the way in which the contingency is presented. I think, if the inspector wishes and they're all done on the same basis, then you'll be able to compare like for like.
If I can just clarify my question or the figures I've provided, as I think I mentioned earlier, all of these figures are on, well, the HIAS is on the basis of 10% contingency, which is the lowest they apply, and yours is on the basis of 5% contingency. So these figures don't have the 40% contingency in. That would be a further enhanced infrastructure differential. So I'm talking about you've got relatively comparable infrastructure contingencies. You just have a lower infrastructure amount.
Well, they are at, what are we at, 51 per unit, and you're saying, I'm saying that they're higher. What are they? 64. So they are higher, and I believe that did include the contingencies. But without sitting down and looking at the numbers directly, I can't really compare apples for apples. We may be talking about the same thing, we may not be. So I think I'm happy to do that and sit there and look at them, but I can't make sure that we're talking directly. I can take your word for it, but I think that's my view.
Sure. No, I mean, I understand that you might have to have a closer look at them. But I guess we could probably find common ground in, if the difference were, you know, if the difference on a somewhat on as comparable basis as possible were to be 140 million across the life of the project, and there was a significant difference in phasing, then that would explain a very large proportion of the interest cost differential, one would think.
Possibly. I mean, again, I think we'd have to look into that and present it in a way that the inspector asked us to look at it.
Yes, thanks, sir. I think it's a similar response in respect of, yeah, we have a different approach to that. I would like to draw out from our appraisal an actual figure for the debit interest so that I can answer the question correctly in due course, if that's okay.
Thank you. Are there any further questions on this point? Otherwise, I'm going to take a break and then come back and deal with the infrastructure questions after that. All right, let's break till 20 to 4 then, please.
Please hold, your meeting has been temporarily adjourned. 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 Please hold, your meeting has been temporarily adjourned.
Thanks. Okay, so I'm going to take one more round of questions to the site promoters, and then we'll move on to hear from Mr. O'Connell and Mr. Sunnox. So, Mr. O'Connell, would you like to put your question, please?
Thank you, sir. I just picking up, so before the break, we would asking Gio Hurd and Gerald Eve around the impact of lower infrastructure and much later phasing on the interest cost. So I now turn to Savills for that question. Turning to Savills, I understand your model starts in a different place to the high S1, so the comparison which I cited or asked about for other for the two West of Braintree analyses wasn't quite so straightforward for yours. But I compared again on the basis of 10% contingency with professional fees, so it's sort of like for like. I just wondered if you could help with these numbers. So for the first 3,000 homes, I guess sort of the first phase of the garden community, I had high S with 454 million of infrastructure and your appraisal with 268 million of infrastructure. Do they sound broadly in the right ballpark? I was using your table of four phases of infrastructure. So I guess yours is not dissimilar to in the West of Braintree appraisals. Yours is about 40% below the high S numbers for that phase. For the West of Braintree ones, it was about 30%. First 3,000 homes is about the first 9 years or so, if I recall, something like that.
Yeah, we've done it slightly differently, as is, you know, per the course of viability assessments, apparently, where we've got our phase one is 2,500 homes, and there we've got an infrastructure total cost of 183 million. It might be easier if I break it down on an infrastructure per dwelling for the phases, because I think that actually sort of leads to the phasing question that I suspect you might be coming at by asking this.
That might help, thank you.
Yeah. So phase two, I'll start again so everyone can write this down if they want. Phase one is 2,500 dwellings, infrastructure total cost of 183 million, which equates to an infrastructure per dwelling cost of about 73,000 per dwelling. Phase two is 3,500 dwellings. That's an infrastructure total cost of 248 million, and that's an infrastructure per dwelling cost of almost 71K per dwelling. Phase three is 3,000 dwellings. That's an infrastructure total cost of 109 million. That's an infrastructure per dwelling cost of about 36,000 per dwelling. Phase four is 8,000 dwellings. Infrastructure total cost of 238 million and an infrastructure per dwelling cost of almost 30k per dwelling.
That is helpful, thank you. So I guess the closest thing for my comparison is I thought for 3,000 homes you had 268 million and obviously for 2,500 you've got 183, so it doesn't sound miles apart, I suppose.
No, I mean, yeah, it's an extra 500 dwellings, so there's going to be extra costs. Yeah.
Well, yes, of course. So I think I would observe we seem to have a similar pattern across the developer appraisals compared to the high S appraisals.
That Mrs. Pearson, yeah.
Thank you. Can I ask Savills, please, some questions about infrastructure? The reason I'm concerned is that one of the responses says that the Gate 120 consortium think that the burden of infrastructure under HIAS is too heavy. So could you confirm, in phase one, is there any payment towards a sewage pipeline, either to Coggeshall or to Colchester? Is there any employment land? Is there a secondary school? Is there any A12 access, any new access? Are there any station improvements? And is there, or when is there, some A120 dualling contribution? Because traditionally, Gateway 120's major selling point to the community was a very large, I think, 100 million contribution to the A120. So that's my first question. And then am I right that your assumed build-out rate is 357 dwellings per annum? And if that's the case, have you also modelled 250 dwellings per annum? Thank you.
Can I deal with the second question first, because I can remember that one? The 354 is an average across the whole scheme. So it does vary. It sort of ramps up and then it sort of feeders out a little bit. I think there is a breakdown in the report. I can't remember exactly what page, but I'm sure one of my colleagues will find out and tell me. And we have modelled the 250 dwellings per annum. It is still viable. We just haven't published it. But if the inspector wants, we can circulate that. But we'll wait further into destruction. First question. Again, in our report on page 8 of the viability of assessment, I can't remember exactly what the reference is, but I'll call it the main report. We've broken down what would be provided in phase 1 and phase 2. Phase 1 does include the sewerage. It also includes 2 preschool and primary schools, primary care centre, leisure centre, off-site reinforcements of electricity, primary substation, the A120 diversion, public transport, bus rapid transit, and the business park infrastructure, so that in phase 2, that's when the business park actually comes forward. Phase 2 costs include, again, 2 preschools and primary school, a secondary school and sixth form, primary care centre, another leisure centre, access onto the A12, a new Western Expressway and rail station improvements.
Thank you. Can I follow that up, sir?
Yes.
So, on the sewage, is that an external sewage pipeline or just on-site sewage infrastructure? And if it's an external one, where does it go?
It's both.
Where does it go?
External to Coggeshall.
To where?
It goes to Coggeshall.
Thank you. Do you have is there a cost in there for that?
Yeah, $3 million.
Thank you. The A120 diversion, is that what I would probably call the link road that diverts off the A120 through West Ham back onto the A120 again?
Okay, bear with me. I'm just going to swap with Jonathan, who can actually answer these questions in detail.
Hello.
Hi.
We've got 2 elements in for the A120 diversion. A total cost of, and this is in the first 3 years, so we've got a total cost of $22 million in for that.
Yes, and sorry, is it the road that loops round?
It's the loop at the bottom, yeah.
Thank you. Okay, and sorry, I meant to ask on the I'm a bit obsessed with sewage, but the sewage pipeline, when's that built?
It's year one, so it's before.
Okay, thank you. And is there still, at any point, a Gateway 120 contribution towards the dualling of the A120? And if so, how much?
There isn't a major contribution in the A120 diversion, then, phasing costs. to the A120, sorry, wider, Julian.
Thank you. And by the end of phase one, there'll be approximately 6,000 people. Is that correct? 6,000 people, 2,500 homes?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. But no employment now, no secondary school, no station improvements.
The secondary school actually comes immediately the year after 2,500, so you could bring it forward.
Okay, thank you. And sorry, final question. Primary care centre, when is that built?
Primary care centre comes in at year four. Year three.
Where do I find the detailed year-on-year
They're actually, the numbers aren't in any of the evidence, but the way you can look at when they're delivered is actually in the IDP, which you picked up our delivery programme associated, and it shows you where they're coming.
Sorry, can I just ask, so that is the way it's listed in the phases, but without any dates, as in actual years, and without the specific costings. I've forgotten the lady's name, but it's the list the lady read out.
Yeah, that's from the viability analysis report. It's on pages 8 and 9.
Yeah.
But you're talking about a different document.
Which is the
infrastructure delivery plan.
Plan.
That's,
yeah.
That's the CREATE plan.
It is.
So that shows the year-on-year infrastructure proposals.
As we propose each element to come along throughout the delivery period.
All right. Anything more to put to the promoters? Mr. Sonnox.
Yes, I wanted to just check some of the assumptions because we're struggling to see why this appraisal is so rosy, so optimistic. Am I right in assuming that the density is about 55 dwellings per hectare? Compared to the 35 highest are doing. And is it right that the Savills dwellings are smaller by 6% on average than the highest ones? And is the delivery rate we've covered as well? And is it true that they've got a different, actually in this case, more conservative thing on land acquisition costs than highest? They've got 12 million in for land acquisition costs, whereas I think that slipped between the behind the radiator on the highest ones.
What was the question about land acquisition costs?
It was that the one of the reasons why the land costs are lower is because they're doing 55 dwellings per hectare, which is a lot higher than highest. So they're building more densely.
Yeah. But your last point about slipping behind the radiator, I didn't quite get that one.
Yes, it's the land acquisition cost. So when you buy a piece of land, you have to pay SDLT at 5% and acquisition fees of, 1.5-2%, something like that. So you normally add that in.
Yes.
And, of course, it's something that slips behind the radiator because it's neither in the benchmark nor in the appraisal. It's very, very easy to forget.
And so who's forgotten it?
I think highest have forgotten it.
Oh, highest, right.
Yes.
I see.
Yeah. And in this case, it's triggered by the fact that Savills have put in 12 million quid.
I see. So it's really a question to highest, is it?
Well, it's a question of whether I'm right in thinking that it's a different approach. I'm highlighting a difference between the two.
All right. Thanks.
I'll leave the land acquisition one for a moment. So can I just clarify the questions? So density, we're at a higher density, and house sizes, we're at a lower house size. Okay, so the density, yes, we are high, but it's still very early doors. And also, because of the way that we're modelling the whole scheme, as we put in our submission, there will be a whole different sectors that will be coming forward as part of the scheme. So including things like senior living, which typically tend to be in flats. There'll be some flats that will be around local centres, so that will naturally drive up the density. And there is also naturally a drive for higher density products. We haven't even considered anything involving things like modular builds coming forward, which will naturally also include driving up the density. So, yes, it is high at the moment, but until we have a worked-up master plan, we can't really revise it too far down. The house sizes, on the other hand, I need to check, but I think that they are done in compliance with the Essex standards, house build standard sizes. Bear with me a second. Yes, I've got the nod. So, yes, they might be considered small, but actually they're somewhat larger than a private sector developer could develop for.
They're larger than...
Yeah.
You mean because they meet the standards?
Because they meet the standards. So the space standards tend to be slightly larger than a true private sector. I'm not looking at my private sector developer colleagues in the room because I'm sure that they would question what I'm about to say. But they are done in accordance with the space standards. I think it was North Essex have adopted.
Okay. Do you know if they're 6% smaller on average than the proposals, than the dwellings in the highest appraisal? Do you know that or not?
I'll confess I haven't done the calculation because, again, it's early doors and I suspect as it's worked up through the planning and we actually do some capacity studies as to what can be developed, it will change even further.
Okay. Thank you. Right. Okay. Do you want to come back on the land acquisition cost point, Mr. Smith?
Yes, I was just going to pick that up. I think what Mr. Sonnix is referring to is the instance of stamp duty, land tax and agents' fees in terms of a transaction of the land. And what the highest appraisals have done have included one allowance for a transaction that would be a taxable event. And we've applied that at the serviced land point, which is actually the more expensive point to apply that. We haven't applied it twice. We believe that master developers or the approach would try to do this in the most tax-efficient way and would try and limit it to only one tax event in any event. So we have got acquisition costs in the model, sizable ones, that we've applied it at the most expensive point of that transaction. So there are costs in there.
So what I'd like Mr. Sonnix and Mr. O'Connell to do now, please, is... briefly, it only needs to be brief because I realise you've done a lot of, each of you have done various analyses, sensitivities and so on of the highest models in particular. So you don't need to go through every analysis you've done and what the outcomes were, but just in broad terms, what you've done, why you've done it, and then I'll invite questions to be put to you from anyone who wants to put them. So I don't mind who goes first.
Yes, fortunately, everyone will be pleased to hear we covered a lot of what we've got to say. I've done a paper here that I hope you've got in front of you, and in it it's got two or three diagrams that I'd just like to cover very quickly. The first one is showing how the simple way of calculating net present value. So marked in pink on this bit of paper is a £27 million figure, which is simply an NPV formula. And going right off the page is all the cash flows going out 80 years, or in the case of the 250 thing, all the way to 2113. And that is just a very, very simple way of doing it. And that, when divided by the number of hectares, gives you £9,335 per acre below agricultural value. The highest method of doing it doesn't take the net present value. It assumes that a land price of £58,702 an acre is spread over the period of the development. And that is the... It's not just that it's difficult to buy it. Like, it may be... Let's assume a world where you could do land deals for that long. It would still be wrong because you're comparing future values to present values, which in finance land is just wrong. Just wrong. I don't think I can refer to a rule or a guideline, but you should compare 2020 values to 2020 values. And so we think that's the easiest way of avoiding the error of comparing future values to present values is to take NPVs all the way through. Just think it's a practical way. I think it's in line with the Harman guidelines. It's even in line with some of the material that NEGC has quoted, where they quoted guidelines. It doesn't mean to say, using this NPV, doesn't mean to say we're against an IRR approach. They're both legitimate discounted cash flow approaches. But we just think this is the most practical way of doing it in line with the guidelines and in line with something the Chartered Surveyor world would be familiar with in that it's residual value-based. And when you're ready, yeah? Second diagram I wanted to show was on the next page, and it looks something like that. And it is either the Galliard or the Andrews Field appraisal. I think it's probably the Galliard one. And it's showing you the cumulative cash flows. So what it's showing you is the money they've, the overdraft in the early years, zigzagging up and down. And then at the end, it's showing you the amount of money they've got in the bank. And I've really only included that just to make the simple point that if you're not looking through NPVs, you're looking at the world in through a goldfish bowl, a distorted lens that's showing the figures out in the future massively bigger than they really are. That graph looks, it makes it look as if the profit of 624 million is actually bigger than the peak debt of 96 million. It's not like that, and you know that could be so misinterpreted. The blue line shows what happens if you discount all the figures back. You're getting much more moderate figures. They're much more manageable. The viability appraisals have much more credibility. And you don't get this business of, you know, I've heard councillors saying that these figures are flicking around, these long, long figures are flicking around so badly that the whole thing doesn't have credibility and it's, and it, and just that we should pay no attention to it. If you start using net present values, you start getting something you can actually talk to and relate to. So that's all on NPV. Slightly different subject, and one we've been going on about for 2 years now, is the third graph, which is an upside-down blue line looking something like that, suggesting that your viability, your strongest viability, occurs at about on about a 10-year project. And if you go beyond a 10-year project, you are... You're actually getting less viability, and going beyond about 20 years, you're beginning to go into negative viability ground. And this is worked out on a formula, and I can describe how it's done, but our point is this is reflecting the real world. These are the types of developers that the scales of developers, developments that house builders are looking for. These are the type of things that are being delivered. Where there are longer schemes, you'll normally find they're phased. So house builders are looking out 10 years or so. That's the period when they need to take their profits. That's why this point about when the profits are taken is so important. There is not a market for people taking profits 20, 30, 40 years out. Unless someone can prove me wrong, someone might be there might be an exception to it, but it seems that house builders are looking in that smaller area. I think this is so important because it's so easy to replicate this. You just rerun your appraisals at different sizes, and you'll find them the higher residual land values at smaller quantities. If you look at the Troy Three Dragons report, you'll see that they say that smaller sites fetch higher residual values than large sites. And it's there, plain before our eyes. And yet the whole of the sustainability process has been gone through, decisions have been made on these large settlements without ever looking at this. And I think this is really something that needs to be looked at. And if they do settlements at a smaller size, there's a bigger cake for everyone to share, and we're better off. I can explain the mechanics of that to anyone interested, I'm sure.
Just very briefly. The dots are the they're the actual you ran an assessment which is represented by each of the dots, in other words.
They
is
are the extra...
2 years, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years,
exactly.
And so on.
I did a two-year project. I did an appraisal for that. Now I did a three-year project.
Yep.
And it lines up very... It's arithmetic, so it lines up very nicely.
Yeah, and that's the curve that results from those various points.
Correct.
Yeah. And the assumptions are briefly listed as in the table there.
Yes, it comes straight. All the numbers are taken from highest 2017 for West Ham.
Yeah, yeah. So your two-year project is what, 250 dwellings or 500 dwellings? How does it? What's it?
Yes, it'll be well. If it's a two-year project, then you'll only get 1 year of delivery probably.
Yeah. So incrementally, each one is 250 dwellings bigger than the one before.
That's right. That's right. Yes, you get an extra year on the project, and what you find is that the extra profit you get from selling more houses starts to be gobbled up after 10 years. Starts to be gobbled up by the extra finance costs. Mm-hmm. So this does assume that land is brought up front. Just think it's a terribly, terribly important point. And Cause has published a paper on this called About the Plimsoll Line, and it's been presented at conferences and so on. One more diagram, and then I'm done, sir.
Yep.
Yeah. Last diagram looks like that, and it's got two lines soaring away. Which is the, and we did discuss this morning, but I think it's so graphic to see that by 2098, the end of the Great Tay project, you've got your blue line, which is your 4%, is giving you a factor of 23 times your original costs. Your civil engineering costs are assumed to go up by a factor of 15 times. And there's your land going straight across the page, a factor of just one times. It's the same as it was at the beginning. I just think that is a graphic way of explaining why we have to do something about inflating land and taking the sort of midpoint of that green line and then comparing it to the current land value, the spot land value, is so flawed that no one should take any decisions on it, and I'm really worried that councillors have been influenced by those inflation scenarios. It seems to be a fault in the plan that decisions have been made on something that's so skewed.
Okay. Thank you. Now, Mr. O'Connell.
Thank you. I think I've set out in various consultation responses, hearing statements, my views. I guess I'll just summarise briefly because it also explains the approach that I've taken. Funnily enough, and I say funnily because it's not clear that any other viability appraisals have started from this premise. I started with the inspector's letter of June 18 about viability and the suggested assumptions therein. I then examined the highest viability appraisal initially, and then, of course, some of the private developer appraisals, but let's focus on the highest one for now. And really, my observation, of course, is that these sites are extremely sensitive to key inputs, exactly along the lines of the ones which you've included in your letter, sir. And I would assert, and I would draw reference to Harman guidance in this context, that one should not assume that sites come forward at the margins of viability. The viability appraisals we have before us, I would say in every case, reflect at best marginal viability. But this is before one overlays sensitivities, which is really what I've done in my work. These sensitivities are really just trying to look at a realistic range of assumptions. And when I say realistic, as I note, that includes actually
using the assumptions from your letter, sir. As we've slightly rehearsed all afternoon, really, these projects have an upfront infrastructure requirement. I echo Mr. Sunnix's comments around the size of sites, and it's very clear that larger sites have lower viability because of the upfront infrastructure requirement. It means these projects are highly leveraged. If one overlays the desired policy, by desired policy I mean the policy which the NEAs have outlined and tried to articulate in the highest model rather than the lower infrastructure and slower phasing which private developers have included, then understandably you have quite a very significant interest cost on land. And this causes huge swings from adjustments to key assumptions. So really, I've just in my work analysed the impact as best as I can of using those realistic range of assumptions to show that not only is the viability marginal, but actually you only need to make a small change to one adjustment, and the result can go sort of through EUV. I mean, this is not like a 5k per acre change here and there. Moving on briefly, I would, for the purposes of saving time, I would echo Mr. Sunnix's comments on MPV. It's clearly problematic if I say to you, I'm buying this land off you, but can I actually pay you for it and take delivery of it in X years' time? It stands to reason that it doesn't make sense that you use the land benchmark value today. I mean, that's logical, and I believe it was the premise for the suggestion in your letter, sir, of actually using a discounted cash flow in context. I don't personally have anything against the use of IRR, but I think, again, looking not to go into this in detail, I articulated my view earlier that what we've seen in terms of IRR is really a circular reference and not useful in context. A discounted cash flow that tries to say, you know, we have these land purchases, we discount these cash flows to today, so we compare apples with apples, is a useful discounted cash flow. It's meaningful in the context of examining viability. Turning to inflation, I have not run any inflation analysis myself. I notice you have a question on this tomorrow, and I'll perhaps revisit it then. But I would in general articulate that, you know, inflation is not, as has been sort of softly alluded to, alchemy. Inflation is a future risk. And I think this is the reason that you suggested, I would expect it's the reason you suggested, but also in general, guidance does not suggest using inflation. It's an area of uncertainty. There's no way it can reliably deliver value. I have extensive experience in inflation risk management myself in my professional career. You know, it's the idea that it can generate value in any reliable way, particularly looking into the future, is just flawed in the concept of assessing viability of huge sites. And I guess I would conclude by noting that obviously my approach here, looking at the changes in these assumptions, reflects the higher risk profile of these sites. It reflects the future uncertainty. It reflects as well the importance of this uncertainty being, you know, it's been made very clear to us all along that the sustainable credentials of these sites rely on whole build-out. That, you know, in fact, if we stop halfway through the project, you know, this is an unsustainable disaster. What we have here is marginal viability. Small changes in key assumptions send viability through the floor. And we have to somehow reconcile that with whole build-out being the only sustainable option.
Thank you. So I'll take questions to Mr. Sunnix and or Mr. O'Connell. So let's start over there. Mr. Briley.
Thank you very much, sir. My first question was in reference to the comment of general guidance.
could I have a reference of what that guidance is that was being referred to?
Mr. Sonnex, or then Mr.
I think it was Mr. O'Connell.
I quote relatively extensively from the Harman guidance in my consultation response. I'm happy to look up that specific quote for you briefly now, if it's useful.
Is it the one about margins of viability?
Margins of viability is not in that. It's in the MPPF. But I just wondered whether I'd ask what guidance, government guidance, you're using to direct that, because the Harman report is now effectively out of date, and it was only a planning position anyway.
I believe the Harman guidance has significant relevance here. We're looking at MPPF 2012. Obviously, heard the points you raised earlier. They're not new points. They were outlined in the highest report, indeed. But I would note that actually the Uttersford examination recently also examined under MPPF 2012. I believe you submitted an appraisal yourself. Noted that one of the sites was marginal viability, so it obviously has high relevance.
Yeah, can we not start debating now? It's questions I'm looking for. We've got the opportunity to debate tomorrow, so it's questions I'm looking for at this point.
Okay.
Direct response to those questions.
Again, there was a question there of the guidance said that forecasting wasn't an appropriate method. I referenced earlier government guidance that did suggest it could be, it may be used. You didn't reference that in your response. I wonder if you could give me some thoughts about paragraph, I think it's 17 of the MPPG, or the PPG 2014, in relation to how you look at this on a current day basis or a forecasting basis.
I don't have the guidance to hand, so it's a bit impractical.
Sorry, which
to comment on it.
Sorry to interrupt. Which PPG was it again?
It would be the 14 PPG.
14 PPG,
yeah.
Paragraph.
I'll find you. I'm pretty sure it's paragraph 17, but I can find it for you. It references the way in which you're supposed to look at it in terms of forecasting.
As I was just commenting, I don't have the relevant guidance in front of me. Are you referring, just to clarify, to my comments around inflation?
Yes, about inflation in forecasting, yeah.
Yes. I mean, I guess primarily my comments around inflation, whilst I certainly don't think there's any planning guidance that suggests that inflation should be heavily relied upon, I also draw from an extensive professional context. During my time at Goldman Sachs, I was extensively involved in a number of inflation-linked structured financing transactions. So I obviously have quite a high level of knowledge around inflation. My professional opinion in that context is that, as I mentioned, the idea that inflation can be used as a reliable guide of value creation in the future is flawed and I believe has no place in this examination.
Thank you. Just to clarify, my question was, it said general guidance indicated that forecasting wasn't appropriate, so I just asked where that was.
Mr. Sargent.
Sorry, it's actually me. also, leading on from inflation, and actually, I suppose for me, and forgive me if I'm overstepping my mark a bit here, but bear with me, there is a point to my logic. It seems to be that there's a slight sort of differential in how we should approach viability, whether it's from the sort of economic financing theory or whether it's from necessarily the real-world developer way. I am not here to pass judgment on who is right and wrong, and I suspect, Mr. Inspector, that you don't want to go anywhere near that argument either. However, I will say that as RICS professionals, we have to adhere to RICS guidance and the RICS professional statement. We have a slight issue with this examination in that the RICS professional statement that came out earlier last year does take effect from September. However, obviously, this is being examined under MPPF 1. There is also a new RICS guidance note that will be coming out. That is still in draft. So I have looked at the old one, the 2012 one, which came out after the Harman guidance. There are certain similarities between the two, but there are also certain differences. And I particularly highlight in Appendix D.
What are you talking about now? The
RICS guidance note 2012.
Viability and planning.
Yeah. And in Appendix D at D33, page 35, should anyone want to write that down? It's 2012's the date, but yeah, it's guidance note 94. Yeah. Appendix D, it does explicitly state for large schemes with a lengthy development period or even larger schemes where phased development is likely, the effect of inflation or deflation needs to be considered. That to us is key, and I think one of the things we're getting very sidetracked on is whether it's right or wrong. From an RICS point of view, we have to examine it, which is why, in large parts, those on this side of the table have. My question is, and apologies, there was a question at the end of this, is a few of the examples that you've also raised, particularly saying about house builders only wanting 10-year projects, I would say that that is true for a typical development project, but I don't think anyone sitting around this table is saying that any of these three guide communities are typical. And I would also argue that perhaps over the past 10, 15 years, we've seen more and more of these large-scale development projects come forward, all of which have come forward, and all of which will have had the same infrastructure burden or a similar infrastructure burden that we're talking about in these garden communities. Therefore, can you provide me with any examples that you've considered as part of your analysis?
I guess you raise a couple of points. I'm not sure if the question was for me or Mr. Sunnix. Maybe we'll both have a go. You raise a couple of questions. One is on the use of inflation. I would note, I would reiterate my earlier comments. I guess I would also allude to the fact that if one is going to use inflation, one should at least do it properly. I referred at some length earlier to the incorrect use of finance rates and the significant overstatement of viability by using a real finance rate in a nominal model or vice versa. I think in some ways this illustrates how clumsy this sort of analysis can be, and it sort of links into your... This is not directly addressed at Savills or anyone else, but just an observation. You know, it links into your second point. We're talking here, the inspector referenced this last week quite rightly, in my view. We're talking here about reasonably unprecedented projects in terms of size, infrastructure burden, the co-delivery of them across a relatively small area. You know, this is not standard stuff. So I think when we're looking at viability, which is simply marginal at best, before one looks at the assumptions which the inspector considered, the idea that one can sort of save that by using inflation, frankly, in a technically incorrect way anyway, to try to salvage viability, I think is. Respectfully, I think it's problematic.
You haven't answered the question. Did you look at real world examples in your analysis of similar schemes?
In terms of similar schemes, I mean, I don't think there are many real world examples in this context. I think what the NEAs have done. You know, we've seen across the examination, I would assert, that there are problems, missing items in capital costs. But what they have done is tried to do significant work on overlaying infrastructure and policy. But I think there are some holes in that. But anyway, what this produces is for these specific sites, you know, which are very site-specific, west of Braintree, for example, is in the middle of nowhere. It clearly has very high transport infrastructure requirements that other sites wouldn't have. It's very difficult just to, you know, work from one one comparable to another. How many sites really have land bought very neatly every 2 years with no additional compensation for the landowner? You know, how can we really find comparables for these sites? I think we have to look at the evidence base and we have to undertake our analysis from there in a way which leads us to look at whether there is real viability for these sites, whether it is likely that they will be built out in whole fashion. That to me is the fundamental pillar of viability.
Can I just ask Mr. Sykes if he wants to add anything to that answer, and then I'll come back to Ms. Gregory.
Yes, I do. I think the problem is that there are not many similar schemes, and many have been tried and failed over the years. My career has been as finance director of property companies, as first finance director of a property company in about 1990, I think. So I've seen a lot of schemes. I've seen a lot of appraisals coming and going, and I know that these big ones fall over. So I think that's really exactly our point. The other thing is about Appendix D and being required to do inflation appraisals. Well, absolutely fine. What we have done, okay, and I'm not going to quote you paragraphs because I can be outquoted by our friends opposite on that. In fact, I go and seek their advice on these things. But what we have done is look through the guidance to see that there is nothing telling you that you can't do proper finance theory on these appraisals. There's nothing saying that you have to have flat land prices and extrapolated inflation rates and everything else. I couldn't find anything along those lines. So where it says nothing, I assume that you can go back to financial first principles, which is where we're strongly coming from, and you still fit in with the guidelines.
I think you wanted to come back, and before you, well, either before or after you do, can I just ask you, do you have any comparable schemes in mind that you know that could have been used to inform the analysis by Mr. O'Connell or Mr. Sonics?
I'll be honest, not at this scale, but I would say that actually I would say in the past 15 years particularly there's been an increase in these larger schemes coming forward, particularly when you combine it with the government public sector release in terms of the MOD land. We only need to look, you know, sort of Cambridgeshire way to see all of those sites coming forward and will continue to come forward, all of which are large-scale schemes and have very heavy infrastructure burdens because MOD sites tend to be very, very dirty. So, I can provide a whole list of schemes of, you know, 2,000 units plus that have come forward. And for developers, ultimately, it's just a case of scaling up. I know it sounds stupid, but yes, it's large. But once you're doing sort of 2,000 plus, it's just a case of scaling it up, making sure you've got your infrastructure done at an early stage, which I think this local plan examination is proving has very much been done, rather than leaving it until the outline planning application stage, which tends to be the usual, you know, 5-10 years ago. But the other thing I would also say is that I think this is going to continue. There's new players coming to the market all the time, my clients included, and they have access to a whole range of funds that typical developers don't. L&Q, for example, they're a not-for-profit organisation. So although we've built profit into our model, that doesn't mean to say that actually if it is L&Q that build it out, which we're intending it will be, that's still a bit of leeway in there. So, and it's not just L&Q. There's other affordable housing, well, traditional affordable housing providers who have access to these vast sums and I think probably will have more of a role going forward. So all I would say is that yes, it's big, but it's not crazy big because otherwise, quite frankly, the developers around the table wouldn't be doing it.
Just ask you, because the point about L&Q being a not-for-profit has been raised a couple of times. So let's just clarify what L&Q is. Is it what I used to know as London and Quadrant Housing Association? And yes, please.
What I was proposing to do is yes is the answer.
Yeah.
We have selected about 4 pages from the last 2 financial statements, which will provide you with, from the horse's mouth, a description of what they do, what their charitable objectives are, and how, because of their asset base, which I say is about £12 billion, they are able to deliver things which other people are unable to deliver. With your leave, I would like, it hasn't yet been printed, I'd like to give you those four pages tomorrow. Maybe you can think about it, or I can just give them to you and you can decide whether to accept them. But
I think the latter would be helpful, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
May I do that tomorrow morning and then you can decide?
Yes, I won't make a commitment to accept them. I'll see whether I think they're going to be useful before I do that.
Very well.
But my question really was going to be, therefore they're not for profit in the sense they don't have shareholders, they don't issue dividends and so on, but presumably they will want to make a profit in order to cross subsidise their other activities. That presumably is why they'd enter into this in the first place.
I'm kind of looking over my shoulder because I have a feeling that my L&Q colleagues might be either shaking their heads or nodding, depending on what I'm about to say. But when I say that they're not for profit, ideally, yes, they would like to make a profit from this. But what I'm also saying is the approach that we've taken, which is the 27.5%, is actually quite a steamy profit. The reality is that actually they would take something much less, but we've adopted it in a pure delivery blind approach.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Right, some others have been waiting a while to ask questions, so let's hear from them. So, Mr. Fell.
It was a couple of questions for Mr. Summix on his graph that fits here with the line. Just to understand some of the assumptions that sits behind that, am I right in saying that all the dots here which you've run the appraisals and that show this line are all on the basis that these are day one land acquisition costs?
Yes.
Okay, so in the real world, which is a number of things that we've talked about, as larger schemes happen, obviously there are mechanisms to draw down land through option agreements that can deal with increases through overage, through various other mechanisms. If a landowner wanted to take a day one price for land over a 20-year period, he would take a discount on that price on day one. So if I was to buy a 100-acre site and I was a landowner and I was seeking £177,000 per acre, it would be unrealistic for me to expect that I'm going to receive £177,000 per acre for 100 acres on day one. So there would be some discounting element for the landowner if he wanted to work on that set of assumptions, which would not really fall into the real-world assumption as to how larger sites are acquired and how they are drawn down. And the concerns about how you deal with land value on that is fairly standard through promotion agreements, through option agreements, to deal with whether it's a planning uplift, whether it's a sales uplift, but you can deal with that and still maintain various parts. The second question I would have is on the infrastructure costs through this process over that time. Obviously, infrastructure costs, as we've talked about, is front-loaded through a scheme. So you become more profitable. If you're looking at a land trader model, your service parcels of land towards the end of a longer period are much more profitable than they are at the beginning, because the majority of your infrastructure, particularly the main roads and all the initial high costs, will have been dealt with in the earlier years, and your infrastructure towards the end is generally smaller. Some of that's picked up through Section 106 trigger points and various other mechanisms. So my question on this graph, which I suspect is, I could be wrong, but I think is an arithmetic exercise to look at these, I would just ask that you would be able to address some of those points as to how this might look in the real world.
Okay. Yes, it is an arithmetic exercise, you're right. Your point on land discount up front, exactly. Or another way of putting it is there's a cost of holding the land, which has to be recognised sometime. So whether it's a discount up front or interest accrued later, you still come back to the same net present value. That's the joy of what we're doing, is you can say, this is the net present value from the cash flows available to buy land, and then you can say, that's the amount up front, but then you do your land deal with the landowner, and you can, according to who's got the lowest or the highest cost of capital, you can structure it over that period. So I think however you buy the land, this still applies. Second point on land is that the phasing is, in my experience, you know, up to 10 years, okay. Landowners might look at that. Maybe someone's got a deal 15, maybe there's an option that goes up to 15 years out there. I would challenge anyone to quote me a land deal going out these 20, 30, 40, 50, 80 years.
no one would tie up their great-great-grandchildren like that. We've heard about one family in Cambridge who's doing one of the bigger Cambridge sites, and I've forgotten which one it is, about 6,000 houses, and they've got one of these long-term deals, and there's intergenerational conflict between the families. They're not, the children are fed up with the parents for signing up something so long that ties their hands so long. So I would argue that we are in the real world, and this is based on, this graph is based not only on a bit of arithmetic, but on watching the real world.
Could I just come back on that,
yeah,
on the discount or holding perspective? So
yeah,
if a landowner wants to receive maximum value, let's call it £177,000 an acre, your premise is that either he accepts a discount now, mm-hmm, or a developer has to pay the holding cost of holding that. What I'm saying is the reverse. If a landowner wants to receive the maximum value for that land,
yeah,
he does not put the burden of interest on his land purchaser, the developer, to draw down that initially, because he is saying that I will take a tranche payment. So if I want to receive my maximum value over a 10-year period, the only way to do that as a landowner is to take deferred payments, which doesn't put the burden of interest costs on the developer and gives the landowner the certainty of a minimum price, let's call it £177,000 an acre over 10 years, and at the drawdown would be subject to uplifts through overage or sales overage or planning overage that gives him the certainty as to why he would agree to that mechanism. So he's protecting himself with his minimum 177 and will see uplift on that on the assumption that there is uplift through sales growth, which is where you would see inflation, but you would only really pay it through the proved sales growth and proved planning gain.
So at what point on that scenario does the landowner actually get his money? When is it paid over to him or her?
So it's generally paid in staged tranche payments. If you, where you have a requirement to a large level of infrastructure on a large site, you may need to, you know, there's going to be a minimum amount of land that you have to have under control to undertake infrastructure.
Yeah.
But many of the phases, the service parcels of land that are, yeah, going to come on stream later down the line, if a landowner wants to receive his maximum value, he is prepared to take, you know, money over a period of time. If he wants it all on day one, there are instances when that happens, but that would be a scenario where a landowner would have to be prepared to take a discount on today's value. But I'm just saying that there are mechanisms, quite normal mechanisms, as to where you wouldn't put the burden of interest on the developer, and as a landowner, you can maintain your price that you want. You just accept that you're going to take that over a period of time. If there are uplifts, both parties share in the uplift.
Yeah. So if there are uplifts, parties share in it. There's a minimum land value written into the agreement, which the landowner will get, come what may.
There are many mechanisms, but yes, I mean, if I was a landowner, and let's just call it simple numbers, £100,000 an acre,
yeah,
I want £100,000 an acre for my land, and I've got 100 acres, 500 acres, whatever it may be.
Yeah, yeah.
I am saying I am prepared to enter into a period of time. Now, I accept there's not going to be one that's going to go 50 to 80 years, but these are going to be, even under the scenario we have, you can look at it in parcels that will be dealt with at various points in time. But you can have the mechanism without overcomplicating it. You don't have to put all the burden on a developer to purchase it all on day one and then fund the interest costs on parcels of land he's not going to be taking benefit of servicing and selling for 15, 20 years.
Okay, I hear what you're saying about the interest, the way the interest is dealt with, but if the agreement is for a minimum land value of 100,000, why would you then take a discount on that if you have it on day one, if you've agreed a minimum price?
I'm saying in the real world you probably wouldn't. So the only scenario where that's likely to happen is if you have a landowner that says, I'm not prepared to be in this for 10, 15, 20 years, and they actually just want a single payment.
Oh, I see. So they refuse the phase payment agreement.
Correct. So
they want to bring everything forward to today.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
But for viability modelling, we look at a, you know, the benchmark land value. But it was just in response to this here that suggests, in my opinion, this isn't how the... If you applied real-world mechanisms to how you can protect both the landowner's return and a developer's ability to pay that money, I'm saying that the upfront cost of this would create this, and I'm just suggesting that's very arithmetic.
Yeah. OK, I'll hear if Mr. Sonnix wants to respond to that, and then I'll need to take somebody else because there are people waiting.
Yes, I think we are saying the same thing. I think, however you present it, it is that the developer ends up paying that interest cost, whether it's because he's given a discount up front or whether he's paying a higher price later. I think we're sort of saying the same thing. question of the real world is, you know, has anyone seen 20 years plus on these option agreements? Does it exist?
I don't think I've heard of examples around the table, but if people have, you know, want to say that there are examples, then fine.
If it helps the inspector, I'm working on the eco village in Bicester, yep. And some of those option agreements run for those periods of time, if not more.
For what period of time?
Well, the one that I'm at the moment is 20 years.
20 years.
But right. I am aware, I could find out overnight, there are longer ones that my firm are dealing with.
Yeah, okay. And the one in Cambridgeshire that you referred to, Mr. Sonnox, presumably is longer than 10 years, is it?
Yes, I think it was. We know it's caused grief.
Okay. Mr. Smith has been waiting the longest, I think.
Yes, I've got a few rather detailed points on the modelling clarifications, which I maybe come back to, but on just...
Quick.
Sure. Yes, there aren't many. It was just an observation on that previous debate. My career has been spent dealing with large sites, and I track what's going on in the sector and the market there, and I do have a list of sites in various stages of the planning system, and I'm aware that there are 52 sites over 2,000 units that are actually on-site delivering now. So I think that in terms of the, graph with the viability decreasing after 2,000 units, and back to that debate around what happens in practice, there are plenty of sites that are out there, and I could quote many of them, but mindful of time. And I could make that list available if that was useful to people to see which sites are actually out there and practising. Back to sort of what my queries were, I had a couple of queries for both Mr. Sonnox and Mr. O'Connell. One was related to the timing of the NPV, and just so that I've got this correct in my mind, and so Mr. O'Connell has dated the NPV back to 31st of December 2019, and Mr. Sonnox is 2020. Is that correct? And that then flows on to another question as to whether any income has been included in the appraisals for having that land under your control. Obviously, there's a huge amount of land that would be acquired under that approach. On Colchester Braintree borders, I think we're at 2,900 acres, and therefore that would be an income-generating asset through that period. You'd only be developing it in a piecemeal fashion. Therefore, there'd be some income you'd expect from that as an asset. So a question as to whether that was in the models, I'm not sure I could see that there was an allowance for that.
Perhaps we'll take all the questions first rather than piecemeal.
There was only one other question related to the modelling type approach. This was specific to Mr. O'Connell's model. And on the model Dell version, which I think is the version that you've extended the timescales on the west of Braintree, it was just a question, because it was raised earlier on in the session around the difference in terms of the residual land value that you considered was greater than we had modelled. And I raised the point that there's an issue of cost, but there's also the issue of land value return. And so could I just ask how you have remodelled the land value return? Because when I look at it, it looks like there is a difference between what I've modelled and what your figures are. And that adds up to, I did similar sort of analysis as you've been doing on time frame. So over the first 10 years, the land value return from the highest modelling was 282 million, whereas in your extended period, that was 268 million. So there's a difference in terms of that value, and actually overall there's a 6 million difference, which may be more negligible. But it was important to get the phasing of the values correct, as well as the phasing of costs. So there were two specific issues around the modelling approach and what's in or not in various models.
Can I hear, Mr. Sargent, have you got a question as well? Oh, sorry, it's Mr. Briley, beg your pardon.
Yes, this is for Mr. Sonnox as well. It was just to do with the graph, and just in response to the graph that was referenced for Galliard Homes. I mentioned earlier that there is a position in terms of risk over time, and I said that if you were coming in later into a development, you would have less things to do, and therefore your profit return would be much greater than at the beginning. And I think that graph demonstrates that perfectly well to me, that actually, if I didn't have to do all the infrastructure and stuff at the beginning, I'd actually make a great return. And my point is that when you look at it overall, you're balancing the profit return from the top of the graph to the bottom of the graph, and you create an average. And there's no averages on
there or lines of curve on there to represent what the profit over the entire scheme is. But I think actually that demonstrates what I was trying to explain, which is that doing a profit overall shows the fairness between the beginning deficit and the greater profit return at the end when you haven't got to do anything. So I just wanted to respond on that point. Again, similar to others, we have got plenty of schemes which I would reference produce about 50 grand per unit worth of infrastructure costs. And again, similar size. I think I've heard several of them mentioned, not so much today, but in other days, such as Alconbury, Water Beach, Otterpool was mentioned, Camborne, North Weald, Aylesbury. There's many out there at this level. So I think that should be more comforting. In terms of the options, most options are sort of the length we're talking. And I don't see the need to have an option that length. If you've got a site which is allocating a local plan to deliver this, the latter phases will buy in when they need to. But you can simply have an option which has extensions in it. So I've had plenty of options when I used to work for a developer where we would sign up to something like a 15-year initial, and then we would, if things were going well, we might extend it for 5 and actually have another 5 with the extensions as well for planning process, EIPs and things like that. So it's quite capable of having an option at that sort of length.
Questions before I ask for a response from... Okay. Right.
Okay. I probably missed some of the points, not being very efficient. Income on land, Mr. Smith is absolutely right, there is a small amount of income coming off farmland. It's normally about 1.5% of the value. It's very, very low. Value of farmland, and I know this because I'm responsible for some farmland, comes in what you can do with it, not from the agricultural income. Brexit coming up, that 1.5% looks as if it's going around to plus minus 0%. I don't think there's very much income on land there. But you're right, there would be some income on land to take account of if we thought it was material.
Did you take account of it in the work you did?
No. But I don't feel it's material, just to repeat. Then the Galliard graphs, I relate to what the gentleman said about them, and I think in a way I was saying the same things. But the interesting thing about looking at these graphs is they give you an idea of what the sort of underlying assumption on the dividend policy is. So here you have some minuses in the early years, and they're paying 6% interest on that. And then I think in the case of Galliard, they've got 0% credit interest. Is that correct? I think it is.
Yes, we've just used standard assumptions used for viability. Yeah,
which is okay, but it's how they work through that to the assumption about when the developer takes dividends that is so critical. And I'd suggest people go and have a play with it, because it really is critical to the interest calculation. So what I think is happening on this graph is where it goes cash positive, the underlying assumption is that the developer is beginning to take dividends. So that is in about 2040, it goes cash positive. And then the balance at the end shows what he would have taken in total, 624 million, if he had waited over the whole period. Now, the question for us, there's nothing wrong with that, and you need a bigger profit if it's a longer contract. I don't doubt that. But the point we're making is that the market is not there, and even L&Q, with all its power, they still have a cost of capital. They still have people like me sitting there as finance directors making sure there's a profit on these schemes. So assuming that L&Q is a bottomless pit, a charity that's going to bung money into this business on a sub-commercial rate of return, seems to be a shaky place to support a plan. Have I covered the... There was something about options and extensions, and someone was quoting up to about 20 years. Well, that doesn't seem... You know, that's the world I've lived in up to 20 years, but it's the longer ones that I don't think any of us have lived in. To risk a project that's needed to complete the project, to risk having to buy the land in later,
who knows what the price is going to be? And will you really be able to get a no-scheme value backdated to the beginning of the... So it seems a very risky assumption to enter into one of these schemes, infrastructure up front, unless you control the whole of the land. And my very simple conclusion, looking at the other schemes we've got, is that basically you need to own the land on day one, otherwise you haven't got a scheme. Thanks.
Mr. Briley, do you want to...
It was only on the first point. I'm not going to reference on the option.
Well, go on, because I wanted to ask you about the graph, but go on. Yeah.
Okay, so the first thing is if we looked at that graph and we looked at it on a programme that was 10 units, it would look exactly the same. You would have your costs up front and your profit return later. It's just representative how you do a development. I just want to ask the question, is it reasonable for the local authority, in the absence of... seeing a garden village out there before, to divert away from assumptions that have been used in other inspections and assessments of viability? Or do you think it would be more reasonable for them to follow that approach and demonstrate it in a consistent manner, in accordance with MPG, that it was deliverable?
That sounds like a question to me, which I'm not going to answer.
No, I think I was asking myself the question.
So, yeah, let me just note that down. So you're saying if there were no other examples, because is that the point, even if there were no other examples?
Well, maybe, but there was a point about there's nothing written in the guidance, which I would dispute, but there's nothing written in the guidance that says we can't do it the way we're doing. And I'd say, well, if that's the case... would it be reasonable for the authority to diverge away from how inspectors and other viability assessments have been for the last 10 years being assessed to an approach which may or may not be more accurate, but is a divergence from that and therefore would be considered inconsistently and not be evidence-based?
I see. Yeah. Just on your graph, not on your graph, Mr. Sonics's graph.
To be clear, if you'd asked, I'd have generated this and we could make sure it was accurate. But
interpreting your cash flows. His point was, I think, well, tell me if I'm right, first of all, Mr. Sonics, that 624 million profit is not incorrect, but it's the profit... you would only get that profit at that level if you waited right until the very end of the build period and then took it all in one go. And in reality, you would actually take profit in chunks over time, and it would not be 624 million because it wouldn't scale up to that amount, because you would be taking it out bit by bit over time.
Well, it would still become the same in terms of assessing it as a return, what the scheme can afford as a return. It would still be the same point. I think the reference is really, if you've got a large amount at the end and not much at the beginning, and you're waiting a significantly long time and no developer in the real world would wait that long,
yeah.
I think that's not quite accurate, because that, you know, arguably, I don't think a single developer is going to be doing this. This is going to be a consortium and a process through. And those sort of things usually have equalisation agreements and delivery agreements between the parties. And some parties will have been out for years in terms of land and delivery and still be receiving an income stream from their agreement at a latter stage. So there are plenty of mechanisms to overcome those problems. But it would seem unreasonable. I mean, doing one at the moment, it seems unreasonable to burden a landowner and tell him his land is worth nothing because of the infrastructure, and therefore I'm not going to pay you anything, and pay someone at the end a lot of money. The way you overcome that is you balance that out and equalise it. And that's what I was saying about a sort of an average across it all. And we're saying that overall the scheme can generate 20%. It's just a slight nuance between sitting on the ground and doing it and actually how you assess this in a viability grounds.
Getting towards 5 o'clock, we've got time for one more question over there, and then I think that probably will be it. So, Mr. Spilsbury.
It wasn't a question, sir. It was a response to what was just said then, and perhaps a clarification from my perspective. I'll be brief.
Okay.
The point on the graph, which I think you were you were alluding to about when you take the profit out, and it was suggested that you'd get the same amount if you took the profit out earlier. That's correct if you're fixing the profit margin. But clearly, if you took that profit out earlier, it would have an impact on the finance cost, which would rise. Which is the valid point to consider. So that would then go direct to the residual land value. You could equalise the profit to resolve the issue that Mr. Burley said if you simply drew out in phases, or you would just have a look at how that might profile slightly differently but still draw out in phases, which I, or when there's a positive cash balance, which is what Savills, I believe, have done, but the other promoters haven't.
Okay. Do you want to say anything more, Mr. Briley, before I go to Mr. Sonics?
No, you've definitely heard enough from me, I think.
Mr. Sonics.
Yes, I've just got a point that the bulk of the profit in here is going to be in the master developer profit. It's going to be house builder profit, and you're forced to give it out earlier. You're forced to give it out earlier. The house builder won't buy a plot. He will net the profit effectively off what he pays for the plot. So you're having to pay it out over the period if you're going to do anything like that. So then you have to account for the interest earlier. Taking an overarching, a mega house builder model, which a lot of these, both the west of Braintree's for a mega house builder with mega periods, you could theoretically wait to the end. I don't think the market's there to do it. But if you're going to have a master developer profit, you have to take it out over the period.
Thank you all very much. Very valuable, I think. And a lot of that will flow into tomorrow's discussions and debates when we come back at 9:30 to, well, I'm going to say do it all again, but not exactly do it all again, but cover the similar topics. So 9:30 tomorrow. And can I please remind you now that the room is required for the football club tonight, so we need to be out of here by 5:30 at the very latest, if possible sooner. Thank you.